they stopped and plopped down on its rear. It let out a few whining bleats and seemed to shrivel into itself, shrinking to its original negligible size. Brendan started to go upstairs, then remembered Mother and the homunculi in the basement. He hesitated, cursing himself, then headed back for the corridor that led to the basement storage room and the chamber below. The corridor was thick with smoke. Brendan ran, bending below the acrid fumes, found the open trapdoor, and went down the ladder. The air suddenly became searing hot, and Brendan knew that the fire had spread to the storeroom above. Mannequins were scurrying from Chrysalis's secret chamber, wailing and crying like lost cats. Brendan looked inside. Mother had pulled away from the wall and was flopping and squirming on the floor like a living mattress. Most of the homunculi had pulled away from her, but those attached with umbilical cords were as trapped as she was. Brendan hesitated, almost turning and leaving. Then a vast telepathic wave of fear and desperation washed over him, so powerful that even his non-receptive mind could sense it. Whatever she looked like, Brendan realized, however hideous and inhuman her shape, Mother was still a person. He didn't know if he'd be able to drag her away with only one arm, but he knew that he had to try. He took a deep breath of the smoke-fouled air, gritted his teeth, and stepped into the secret chamber. "I'm coming," he called. He ran into the chamber and managed to tip up a corner of Mother's rectangular body. Her flesh was warm and rubbery and pulsating, and it had a pleasant, somehow soothing smell even in the smoky chamber. He got down on his knees and somehow managed to hoist her onto his back. Sparks sprinkled from the ceiling, and smoke rolled into the chamber like thick fog. "It's all right," Brendan shouted. He caught his breath at the horrible pain in his broken arm. "We're going to make it." Then the ceiling fell in.
11 p.m. The sound of singing floated through the night, a ragged drunken harmony in a couple of different keys. The lyrics were something about hanging Leo Barnett from a sour apple tree. The path curved off to the left, but Jay cut across the grass and through a stand of trees. Blaze followed desultorily, kicking at the occasional rock. The fire was out. The only light came from a few embers glowing feebly amidst the ashes. It wasn't until they were quite close that Jay realized the group of jokers squatting by the tent wasn't a group at all. Or maybe it was, if you count Siamese Quince as a group. By then the singing had stopped. All the eyes were looking at him. The five bodies were twisted and malformed, flesh flowing into flesh in places and ways that made Jay want to turn his head. He wasn't even sure you could really call them Quince. There seemed to be five bodies, but they shared four heads and maybe seven legs between them. On the other hand, they'd come out way ahead on the arm and tentacle count.
"Oh, gross,"
Blaze said with astonishing tact. Jay ignored him and hoped the jokers would too. "Maybe you could help me," he said. "I'm looking for a friend of mine, name of Sasha. Skinny, slick down hair. Kind of a fussy dresser. Has one of those little pencil mustaches. Like you see on desk clerks in old movies." No response. "No eyes. Did I mention that? Just skin." Four mismatched faces regarded him dully. Jay couldn't decide if they were stupid, or hostile, or what. He waited a long, awkward moment and tried again. "Maybe you don't know him. He used to work at the Crystal Palace. You guys from New York?" "I can make it, Ansel," Blaze said eagerly. "Just watch. I'll make it get up and do a little dance." "They don't talk," a woman's voice said from behind them. Jay turned around. He could barely make her out, just a shadowy form sitting under a tree. "I heard them singing," he said.
"They sing," the calm voice replied. It was a young woman. Through the branches, he could see the moonlight reflected on pale white skin. Her dress was unbuttoned down the front, and she was cradling something in her arms. "They sing, but they don't talk."
"Oh," Jay said. He stopped a few feet away from her. He could see one breast, pale and cone-shaped.
A baby was nursing at the other. She stroked it gently as it sucked. She looked very young, no more than 18, sad and pretty. Her baby in her arms was a round red thing, like a bowling ball made of flesh. "I'm sorry," Jay said. "I didn't mean to intrude." "I know where Sasha is," the woman said. In the darkness behind her, someone moved. Jay looked up, saw eyes peering out of the bushes. They were pale green and burned with a dim feral glow. He was staring at them when he heard a soft footstep behind him. The hairs on the back of his neck stirred. There was a sudden overwhelming sense of being watched, and all at once Jay was terrified. He backed away from the woman and the sad twisted creature in her arms, trying not to show any of the fear that was tearing at his guts inside. "Blaze, we're getting the fuck out of here," he said. He turned. Sasha stood behind the boy, his eyeless stare fixed on Jay. Azeli was there too. He could see her body, full and lush. She was naked, and in the darkness, her eyes glowed red, brighter than the embers in the fire. She smiled at him and said nothing. Jay must have made some kind of noise, because Blaze turned around. He saw Sasha, but then his eyes went to Azeli and got big. He grinned, then gave a low hoot of approval that Jay knew he hadn't learned from Tachyon. The boy had no idea of the shit they were in.
"Sasha," Jay began.
"No," Sasha replied.
"Now it's too late for talking."
A man with a club came sliding out of the darkness, his feet bare, silent as a shadow. He swung, missed. Jay danced aside and made his gun with his fingers and popped him away. Someone leaped onto his back. He went down hard and rolled. Long fingernails raked across his face, clawing for his eyes. Jay caught the hands, pried them loose, tried to untangle himself. He got his right hand free, just in time to pop off a small girl who was coming at him from the right. But by then, the woman had sunk her teeth in the fleshy part of his left hand, just beneath the thumb. He cried out. Blaze finally took his eyes off Azili's tits, long enough to see what was going on.
"Hey!" the boy called out.
The woman worried at his thumb with her teeth and tried to kick him in the balls at the same time. Jay slapped her hard, alongside the head, got his hand loose, and popped her right out from under him. Sasha shouted out,
"Stop it! Leave them alone!"
It was enough to freeze everyone for a second. Blaze was staring at Sasha with fierce concentration, holding him in the palm of his mind. Behind him, Jay saw the vast shadow of the Siamese Quint lurch unsteadily to its feet and stumble forward. "Oh, Jesus," he thought.
"Run!"
he screamed to Blaze. He saw a motion out of the corner of his eye and whirled. The thing with the pale green eyes had emerged from the bushes and was gliding silently across the grass, 5 feet off the ground, like some obscene manta ray with a semi-human face. It was naked, its skin pale and pimpled. Male genitalia drooped from the center of its face, beneath those hideous eyes. Jay fought to keep down his lunch as he sent it away, but behind it came others. The looming joker with flesh soft and dark as blood pudding. The boy with the ice pick. The human centipede skittering forward with knives in half his hands. They were all around him. He got rid of the ice pick when he saw the sad-voiced young woman coming at him. Her baby lifted over her head like a weapon. It made him hesitate. Only for a second, but it was enough. A dozen strong hands seized him from behind. The ground dropped away under his feet, and pain erupted everywhere.
Sunday, July 24th, 1988. 3 a.m. His arms were on fire. He didn't remember waking up. He wasn't sure he had.
For a moment, he thought he was dreaming. His nightmare come to haunt him once again. Only this was a new part. After the cone-faced thing began to howl, he tried to open his eyes and saw only darkness. The world had a damp, fetid smell. He couldn't move his fingers. He could feel burning in his shoulders and his wrists, but otherwise, his arms were numb. He kicked feebly, and his body began to twist. He was suspended somewhere, adrift above some vast black abyss. Far off in the darkness, he heard coarse laughter and dim, whispering voices. The cone-faced things were talking about him, Jay thought. He remembered his name then. Somehow that helped. He tried not to listen to the voices. They reminded him of the trees in his dream. Whispering secrets, terrible secrets, he did not want to hear. Then there were footsteps coming up behind him, and the fear rose in his throat. They were coming after him. And when he tried to run, his legs pumped uselessly against nothing. The blindfold was ripped off his face. Sudden light stung his eyes. Jay closed them, whimpering feebly.
"Cut him down,"
a familiar voice said, close at hand. Someone grunted. Against his best instincts, Jay opened his eyes a crack. His vision was blurred and painful. The room took shape around him. A basement, he thought groggily. He was hanging from a pipe, swaying in the air, dangling by his arms. A human centipede advanced toward him, hands full of shiny metal, while a man with an eyeless face watched from below. Sasha, he thought. But when he tried to say the name, nothing came out. Then he was falling, his legs tangled under him, unable to support his weight. And he collapsed, his head hitting the damp stone beneath a solid crack as he fell. Jay groaned. "Give him another shot," a distant voice said. "I don't want to take any chances with him until we've reached Team Alice." "No," Jay tried to say. All he produced was a moan. Someone kicked at his broken rib, rolling him over with a foot. Then there was a bright light shining in his eyes, a sharp pain inside his elbow. After that, he slept.
11 a.m. Chrysalis smiled at him. Brennan thought it was strange to see her again, because he was pretty sure that she was dead. Or maybe she'd just been out of town. He smiled back tentatively. Now that she was back, how would he explain her to Jennifer, and vice versa? He decided to worry about it later and reached for her. They embraced, and he pulled back to arm's length to look at her. His smile froze. Chrysalis was deteriorating before his eyes, her crystal flesh clouded with corruption and fell away from her face and body in rotten chunks. Blood ran in sluggish tears from her eyes, her breath whispered in a ghastly rattle from her laboring lungs. He held the corpse in his arms. He felt guilt tear angrily at him, and with her last gasp, she said, "Brennan." And he awoke, soaked with sweat and shaking from horror and anesthesia reaction. "How do you feel?" someone asked from his bedside. "Fine," Brennan lied. "Where am I?" Brennan turned and looked at the speaker for the first time. He was a young man in a white lab coat with a stethoscope around his neck. He looked like a cross between a surfer boy and a Palomino pony. Dr. Finn, that was his name. "The Jokertown Clinic," Dr. Finn told him. Brennan nodded wearily. "You know," Finn went on, "it's most astonishing that you're with us at all." Brennan nodded again. He was groggy and disoriented, but he was starting to remember things. The fire, Mother, the ceiling collapsing. "It seems," Dr. Finn said, watching him closely, "that a fireman found you in a secret subterranean room when looking through the wreckage of the Crystal Palace. Apparently you were saved from the flames by something that was only a charred, fleshy mass covering your back when the fireman discovered you." "Mother," Brennan whispered. His mouth felt as if it were full of wet cotton batting, and his right arm was a hunk of unfeeling meat encased in a plastic cast. He sat up and swung his legs onto the floor, fighting sudden vertigo that made his head swirl as if he were in the middle of a 3-day drunk. His arm was totally numb, but he knew that the numbness would wear off, unfortunately, quickly.
Where are my clothes?
You're in no condition to leave the hospital, Finn said gravely. Your arm was broken pretty badly, and you've lost a lot of blood. You've also got some burns on your hands and face. You should rest for at least a day.
Brennan shook his head. I've no time to rest.
I can't be responsible if you leave the clinic, Finn said, his tail twitching in distress.
You're not responsible for anything. I am.
Brennan stood and almost immediately collapsed again when he was struck by a severe attack of vertigo.
Now, where are my clothes?
Finn shook his head. If you're really determined to leave, I won't stop you. Wait here a minute and I'll find your clothes. It may take a while because everything's a mess this morning.
The fire? Brennan asked.
No. The Crystal Palace was destroyed, but there were actually very few injuries from the fire. It seems that half the staff was up all night partying with the rest of Jokertown, and the other half is being run ragged, trying to treat the results of their partying.
Partying? Brennan asked. Why?
Oh, I guess you couldn't have heard. Senator Hartman was nominated for the presidency last night. All of Jokertown's gone Hartman crazy.
Somewhere in the darkness, the voices were arguing.
It's not fair, the first voice said. We need the kiss, too. He spends so much time with him. How long is he going to keep us waiting?
As long as he desires, the second voice said. It's not our right to question the master's coming and goings. Team Alice does things in his own time, for his own reasons.
We ought to kill them both, the first voice said. They're dangerous.
No, said a third voice, a woman's voice. Not these sweet ones. The master will want to taste them, to ride them, to feel them beneath him. The master will want to hear them scream. That was enough to open Jay's eyes.
What about us?
He saw the centipede man pacing, his voice high and nervous.
What if he likes them better than us? We'll never get the kiss. I can't stand it when he goes off.
Jay lay face down on a decaying, foul-smelling couch. His head turned to one side, arms tied behind his back. At least he hoped they were tied behind his back. He couldn't feel them anymore. And when he tried to move his fingers, there was only numbness. The upholstery smelled of piss. His head was pounding, and his ribs screamed at the slightest motion. He was still in the same dank cellar. He could see an old hot water heater a few feet away, its pipes eaten by rust. Beyond it was a second room, larger than the one he was in, where shadowy figures waited in the faint light that poured through grime-encrusted windows. Jay tried to count them, but there were too many. Some of them moving around. When he tried to concentrate, his skull felt like it was about to split open. He must have groaned or whimpered, or somehow given away the game. The argument stopped suddenly, and he heard footsteps. Rough hands turned him over toward the ceiling. Sasha stood above him. The telepath looked a little worse for wear. His hands were trembling, and strands of dark hair were plastered to his pale forehead with sweat.
What?
Jay said. It was all he could manage. His lips and throat were dry and raw.
What?
He repeated. Get him some water, Sasha said. A moment later, Azili knelt beside him, holding a glass to his lips. Her hands were hot, but the water was cool, and Jay gulped it down greedily and let it run over his lips and chin.
Sock, Azili whispered in his ear, laughing, and Jay could smell her and feel the heat that came off her skin in waves.
You should never have followed us to Atlanta, Sasha said. Jay sputtered through the last of the water.
My arms, he managed. The ropes. Cutting off my circulation. Let me loose.
I'm blind, not stupid, Sasha said. You can't use your power with your hands tied. You need to point your finger to make believe your hand is a gun.
He's trying to trick us!
The human centipede stepped up behind Sasha. He was tall and stooped, hunched over like a question mark, his face a pinched afterthought on a narrow, hairless head. All his arms were grotesquely long and thin, skin pulled taut over bone and muscle. But there were so many of them.
I told you he was dangerous, the Joker said. Kill him!
He had a long serrated knife in one of his myriad hands.
No, Sasha said. He's too valuable.
A treasure, Azili whispered.
You know how the master feels about aces, Sasha said.
Ask the others,
the centipede man insisted.
Do I get a vote?
Jay wanted to know. Azili laughed, and Sasha turned his eyeless face toward Jay.
You'd vote for life, he said solemnly.
Stupid. His fingers rubbed idly at a large scab on the side of his neck.
You've been a bad boy, Azili said teasingly. What did you do to them, huh? All our lovely friends.
I told you, Sasha said. He teleported them away, to New York City.
The master will be angry, Azili said.
She ran a finger lightly down Jay's cheek, delicately circled his ear.
So many mounts gone. You'll have to be punished.
The master?
Jay repeated.
Who's that? Hartman?
Azili looked at him blankly.
The puppet man?
Jay said, remembering the name Tachyon had used. The centipede glanced at Sasha in confusion.
Is that what this is all about? Sasha said.
You poor sad fool.
You have no idea what you've blundered into.
He gave a short, sharp laugh that had no humor in it. But then again, few of us did, he added bitterly.
I want to play with him, Azili said.
Her hand worked at his belt and slid into his pants.
Not tonight, honey,
Jay said weakly.
I've got a headache.
Azili smiled and took her hand off his cock.
When he kisses you, she whispered, then you will be mine again. He likes to have the new mounts fuck me. He will ride you, and you will ride me.
Some fun, Jay said. Azili ran her tongue across her lower lip. There was a scab on her neck, too. Jay had seen it before, the night they'd bawled on her carpet. But he'd forgotten about it. Now it was right there in front of him, an old sore, crusted over with a scab, just like Sasha's. He looked up at the centipede. The hole in his neck was open and raw, the skin around it red and inflamed. All of them, Jay thought wildly. Not Joker terrorists or militant Hartman fanatics, but something else. Something terrible. His stomach clenched inside him. And again he had a sick feeling of vertigo and a sense of unspeakable dread, as if he had just dropped into his nightmare.
You won't get away with this, Jay said with all the bravado he had left. Blaze will tell them what happened. They'll come after you, Tachyon, Hiram.
He tried to think of who else might come looking for him, and couldn't come up with any names.
I'm a popular guy, Sasha,
he finished weakly.
They're not going to let you fuck around with me.
Azili thought that was hilarious. Her laugh was almost hysterical. The centipede joined in.
The boy won't be telling anybody anything, Sasha said almost sorrowfully.
He reached down and grabbed the front of Jay's shirt and jerked him upright to a sitting position. There. Behind the sofa, a monstrous shape filled the gray shadows along the wall.
In the dimness, Jay saw arms, tendrils, claws, flesh twisting into flesh, and eyes. It wasn't until the creature moved that Jay recognized the Siamese Quint. Blaze was slumped unconscious on a mattress at its feet, wrist and ankles shackled to nearby pipes. His face was battered and bruised, and dried blood had caked over one eye, sealing it shut. All Jay could think was that Dr. Tachyon was going to be really pissed.
Noon. Brennan headed immediately to Our Lady of Perpetual Misery. As he crossed Jokertown, he could observe the tail end of the mass party that Finn had told him about. Drunks were still staggering about the street wearing Hardman Jackson campaign buttons. Hardman banners festooned practically every building, having appeared magically overnight, like mushrooms sprouting after a rain. Hardman posters were stapled to every flat surface. You couldn't go anywhere without seeing his smiling face. His omnipresence was almost eerie, and for the first time Brennan felt some misgivings about such an uncritical, overwhelming passion. Father Squid was still conducting mass, so Brennan slipped in the back of the church and waited, trying to make himself as inconspicuous as possible. The Joker sitting in the pew next to him glanced over once, saw the state of Brennan's clothing, then decided that it was far more important to pay attention to what was happening with the mass than stare at the bloodstained Nat, who sat down beside him. Mass lasted only a few more minutes, but the church took a long time to empty. Brennan caught the priest's eye as he was surrounded by members of the congregation who wished to talk to him, mainly, it seemed, about the coming of Hartman and the expected Golden Age, and Father Squid called Quasiman over and whispered a few words to him. Quasiman shuffled off, and Father Squid gestured significantly to Brennan. Brennan slipped out of the church and went around to the back, where Quasiman was unlocking the rectory. "I hope you're all right," Brennan told the Joker. He could see a series of deep scratches running down Quasiman's face.
"Sure," Quasiman said. "Do you think you'll be needing me soon?"
Brennan looked at him. Quasiman looked back with deep, intelligent eyes that held no memories at all of the events of last night.
"I know. I think I'll be able to handle things now. But if I do need you, I'll let you know." "Okay," Quasiman said. "I'll be ready."
He opened the door to the rectory, and Brennan went quietly inside. The shades were drawn, and Jennifer was still asleep on the couch. Her face looked smooth and serene as that of a child. Her skin color was good. Her chest rose and fell with easy regularity. She looked well on the road to recovery, but Brennan didn't want to jeopardize her health by waking her. He quietly tiptoed to the hallway that led to Father Squid's little bedroom. His bag was sitting by the bedroom door. He took off his battered, bloody clothes and discovered how hard a simple thing like changing pants can be with an arm in a cast. Once he accomplished this, he closed the door behind him and sat down on Father Squid's waterbed and rested for a moment. He took a deep breath. Dr. Finn had been right. He was worn out already. He hoped the rest of the day would be easy on him. Right now, he didn't have the strength to fight half his weight in puppies. He picked up the phone by the bedstand and dialed a number that had been given him by a cat. It rang once. Then a recorded message came on that said,
"We're sorry. The number you're trying to reach is no longer in service."
He hung up the phone. Fade-out worked fast. He even had the telephone company jumping. Brennan sat on the bed, thinking for a moment. Kian might know where Fade-out's headquarters were, but the thought of going to his enemy for help made Brennan gag. He would do it if he had to, but there were others he could see first. There was one other he was particularly eager to see. He put the last weapon he had, a snub-nosed .38, securely in the waistband of his fresh set of jeans, and went out into the living room. He watched Jennifer sleep for a moment and resisted a powerful urge to kiss her. He walked through the living room without making a sound and closed the door silently behind him. Quasiman was sitting in the grass, listening to whatever thoughts they were that drifted like clouds across his mind. "Tell Father Squid I'll be back," Brennan said. But Quasiman gave no sign that he'd heard. Brennan smiled to himself, well aware how lucky he'd been that Quasiman had responded when he'd needed him the night before.
As he went through the churchyard to the street beyond, he wished that he could always be that lucky. He stepped to the sidewalk just as an empty cab went by. Brennan whistled shrilly, and the cab stopped a little ways up the block. Maybe, he thought, my luck has shifted. Twisted Dragon, he said to the cabbie, who nodded, flipped the flag with his flipper, and pulled off down the street. The talkative cabbie was festooned with Hartman buttons, and Brennan let him jabber on about the crucial events in Atlanta while putting in only an occasional grunt to sustain his end of the conversation.
The fur, the cabbie said, is really going to fly now. Hartman versus Bush, oh boy, and if Hartman don't win, Jokertown is going to go crazy. I don't think Tachyon will be too welcome around here. Why do you think he done it?
The cab pulled up in front of the Twisted Dragon.
Why do you think Tachyon turned his back on us?
Cabbie asked Brennan again. Brennan would have shrugged, but the cast made that difficult. I'm sure he had his reasons, he said, only vaguely aware of what the cabbie had said and not at all sure of what Tachyon had done or hadn't done. The answer didn't please the cabbie, who burned away from the curb despite the 20 that Brennan handed him. Brennan went inside the Dragon, dismissing the political maneuverings from his mind. He had more immediate problems to worry about, and so did Lazy Dragon, whom Brennan spotted drinking at the bar. The Twisted Dragon was as crowded and noisy as it usually is, which is saying a lot on both accounts. Brennan simply walked up behind Dragon, who jerked with surprise when Brennan stuck a knuckle in his back, simulating the barrel of a gun.
"Nice to see you again, pal," Brennan said. "Shall we have a little chat?"
Dragon nodded once, and his hands started to go slowly to his jacket pocket, until Brennan jammed the knuckle a little harder into his back.
"Relax. Keep your hands in sight. I don't want you turning into a teddy bear and scaring all these people."
"All right,"
Dragon said quietly, his hands resting flat on the bar.
"What do you want?"
"I could want your ass, chum, but you saved my life once. So we'll call it quits. If you tell me how to get in touch with Fade Out."
"All I have is their phone number,"
Dragon said.
"The one I gave you a few days ago."
Brennan shook his head. "It's no good anymore."
"Then I can't help you."
Brennan stared at Dragon, who returned his gaze steadily. "All right. But if you're lying, if you know how to get in touch with Fade Out and warn him that I'm coming, then it's open season on dragons. And I've got my hunting permit right here." He increased the pressure with his knuckle. Dragon shrugged, feigning nonchalance.
"Why should I care what you white dudes do to each other?"
he asked. "Good attitude," Brennan said, and faded into the crowd. "Cross Dragon off the list," Brennan thought when he hit the street. It was time to visit the Magic Kingdom again.
"Please," Jay said in an urgent stage whisper. The boy's eyes were closed, but Jay could see the tension in his muscles. He was conscious. Jay was convinced of it. Groggy, maybe. Terrified, almost certainly. But conscious. In the next room, Charm was singing. That was what the others called the Siamese quint. Jay had a sick feeling. He knew what that was short for. Sasha had left 20 minutes ago, after saying something about needing to get a new boy. From the conversation, Jay gathered that he had popped away the old boy last night in the park. He wasn't quite clear what they needed a boy for, but it seemed to have something to do with the master's travel plans. Sasha's telepathy would have made any attempt at escape futile. If they were going to make a move, they had to do it now. As near as Jay could determine, there were only 5 people left in the other room, 6 if you counted the grotesque infant nursing at its mother's breast. He figured he could discount the mother and child. Azealia and the Joker, who looked like a sack of blood pudding, shouldn't be too dangerous either. That left only Charm and the Centipede Man. The Centipede sat beneath a window in the other room, a whetstone in one of his left hands, a half dozen knives in his rights, the arms on the right side of his body, moving with a strange rhythmic grace as he sharpened the blades. The sound of steel against stone lent an eerie counterpoint to Charm's singing. "Blaze," he whispered again. "Come on, damn it, wake up!"
The boy opened his eyes. All the arrogance was gone from them now. Even in the darkness, Jay could see how scared they were. The contemptuous junior Mentat had turned back into a little boy on him.
"We gotta get out of here,"
Jay said, trying to keep his voice low.
"This is the best chance we're going to get."
"They hurt me,"
Blaze said. His voice cracked with pain. He spoke much too loud. For a moment, Jay stiffened, but the singing went on in the next room.
"I know," Jay whispered. "Blaze, you have to keep your voice down. If they hear us, we're fucked."
"I'm scared,"
Blaze said. His voice was softer, but not soft enough.
"I want to go home."
"Pull yourself together," Jay said. "I need you. You have to mind control one of them."
"I tried," Blaze said. "Last night, I had Sasha, but they didn't listen to him. And then that thing, that Joker. Too many minds. I wasn't even sure how many. And some of them, it was like an animal mind. Only smarter. And it kept sliding away from me. I couldn't get a grip. They helped me."
He was crying now. A line of red ran down one cheek, where his tears mingled with the dried blood that had closed his eye.
"They're going to hurt you a lot worse if we don't get out of here," Jay said. "You don't need to mess with the big ugly one. Just grab the guy who looks like a centipede. Make him stand up and say, 'I'm going to go check on the prisoners.' You got that?"
"I'm going to go check on the prisoners,"
Blaze repeated numbly through swollen, cracked lips.
"Casual," Jay stressed. "Make it real casual. Then get the fucker back here with one of his knives and have him cut me loose. Once my hands are loose, we're home free. I'll pop you back to the Marriott and you can bring the cavalry. Okay?"
"I don't know," Blaze said.
"I thought you were part Cajun,"
Jay whispered with all the scorn he had in him.
"You guys good for anything but crying?"
Blaze blinked back tears, then nodded slowly.
"I'll try."
The boy's battered face twisted in concentration. Jay held his breath. The singing went on for what seemed like an eternity. Then a chair pushed back, and he heard a thin voice announce, much too formally,
"I'm going to go check on the prisoners."
The singing stopped. Jay heard footsteps. Too many footsteps. The centipede crossed the cellar like a sleepwalker, knelt down in front of Jay, groped behind him, and started sawing at his bonds with a knife. From the sound it made, Jay had the sick realization that his hands were bound with wire, not rope. Charm came in just behind him, lurching forward with a ponderous, stumbling gait. One head glanced over at Jay and the centipede, and ignored them. All the other eyes stayed fixed on Blaze.
"No,"
the boy whimpered, as the Joker's vast, dark shadow fell across him. He tried to scuttle back on the mattress, but there was no place to hide. One of Charm's hands reached up into the pipes that ran along the ceiling and emerged with a baseball bat. The first swing caught the boy's head with a crack that made Jay nauseated.
2 p.m. This time Brennan's approach was straightforward. He knew where he was going. He knew what he wanted to do. Quinn's garden was gorgeous in the afternoon sunlight. He either had tremendous horticultural skills or had hired a superb landscaping service. Brennan wouldn't mind talking gardening with the Eskimo, and if things went right, he'd have his chance. He cut through the poppy bed and approached the caterpillar sentinel from the rear. As it had done the first time he'd stumbled upon it, the machine turned its head slowly, grinned, welcomed him, then dispersed a billowing cloud of gas in his direction. Brennan fell. Artistically, he hoped. He winced when his right arm
hit the turf, and twisted so that his left hand was under his body. He held his breath as the gas dissipated and took shallow, cautious breaths when he had to. He got a little dizzy from the residue gas, but then he was still feeling woozy from his medical treatment anyway. He lay there for 10 minutes before he heard approaching footsteps and a grumbling voice.
"Sunday afternoon," it was saying. "Sunday afternoon. Can't a man be left in peace to enjoy himself even on the weekends? What's this world coming to?"
The grumbling stopped, and through slitted eyes, Brennan saw Quinn staring down at him.
"Now, who's this?" Quinn continued his monologue. "Who's caught in the web spun by my caterpillar? Wait a minute. Caterpillars don't spin webs, do they?"
"That's right," Brennan said, sitting up and pointing his gun at Quinn. "You're thinking of spiders."
"You're unconscious," Quinn said. "You can't talk."
Brennan could see that the Eskimo was badly ripped, but that wasn't unusual. He peered doubtfully at Brennan, seemingly not even cognizant of the gun Brennan was pointing at him. "Running downs through your system this afternoon, Quinn?" He nodded tranquilly.
"Quaaludes."
"Lucky me. Now here's what we're going to do. We're going to go back to your place, then we're going to call up someone else and have a little party. That all right with you?" Quinn nodded agreeably.
"Sure. Sundays are boring anyway. There's usually nothing on television worth watching at all."
"You first," Brennan said, waving his gun at Quinn. He didn't want to get within reach of the doctor in case Quinn realized what was happening and tried to sink his finger needles into him again. Brennan got a better view of the inside of the mansion than the last time he was there. Whatever taste Quinn had in landscaping didn't extend to interior design. The inside of his magic kingdom was decorated in what could best be called exotically eclectic taste. The entrance hall was lined with portraits of famous drug addicts of the past, including Edgar Allan Poe, Sherlock Holmes, Elvis Presley, and Tom Marion Douglas. The room Quinn led him to had a group of display cases that housed, among other things, a collection of Chinese opium bottles and antique Turkish water pipes. Against one wall were terrariums with rare and delicate species of fungus and cactus. Against another were aquariums with various species of pufferfish. "Quite a place you got here," Brennan said, gazing about in wonder.
"Thanks," Quinn beamed. "It's thematic, you know."
"Yeah," Brennan said. "Now I want you to make that phone call."
"Who are we calling?"
"Fade out. I want you to get him here fast. Tell him you discovered something new. Something important that he has to see right away. Can you handle that?"
"Hey!"
Quinn stood straight up.
"Sharp as a tack."
But he stopped and peered at Brennan.
"But why should I?"
Brennan decided that subtlety was out of the question. "Because I got a gun," he said, pointing at Quinn. "And I want you to."
"Hey!" Quinn said, backing away. "I was only asking."
He went to the telephone, and Brennan kept pace behind him, out of arm's reach. He peered at the number that Quinn was trying to dial. It was different than the number the fade-out had given him, as Brennan had suspected it might be. He didn't think fade-out would hand out his secure number to just anyone. Quinn, meanwhile, was having difficulty dialing, but finally made it through on the third try. Brennan positioned himself before Quinn, where the Eskimo could see his gun.
"Hey, hey," Quinn said into the receiver. "Guess who?" "That's right. Coo-coo-coo-choo." "No, wait a minute. That's the walrus. Anyway, it's me, Quinn." "Yeah, listen, fellow boy. I was fooling around in the lab today and came up with something you've just got to see." "Sure, I'm sure. Everybody's going to jump for joy." "Hey, has the Eskimo ever let you down?" "Well, recently, I mean." "Okay. Okay. When you can make it." "Sure. Adios."
He hung up the phone. "Well?" Brennan asked.
"He's got some stuff to do. But he'll be by in an hour or so. Say, want to see my greenhouse? I've got a great collection of marijuana plants."
"Sure," Brennan said. "Why not?"
3 p.m. The sound of footsteps on the stairs made Jay open his eyes. It was very quiet. He had been sleeping, or drifting in and out of consciousness. It was hard to be sure. He glanced over toward the mattress and saw Blaze staring at him. The boy's eyes were wide open, fixed in terror. A froth of blood bubbled out of his mouth where Charm had knocked out some teeth. He didn't seem aware of it. He didn't seem aware of anything. The footsteps got louder. Jay squirmed along the couch, his useless hands still bound behind his back, and tried to get a good look into the next room. Hiram Worcester stepped into the basement. Jay blinked. For a moment, he thought he was hallucinating. Then he gathered all the strength he had in him and screamed,
"Here! Hiram! I'm back here!"
Hiram's head snapped around. Charm lurched to his feet and moved slowly out of the shadows.
"Watch out!"
Jay yelled. He heard Azili laughing. Hiram was carrying a suitcase, huge and black, closed with three bright brass hinges. It was so large it was almost a trunk. But he carried it as easily as a normal man might carry a briefcase, and Jay realized he had made it light. Charm took it from him and set it on its end reverently. Six hands began working simultaneously on the latches. Jay Ackroyd went cold all over. Hiram looked at him across the length of the basement. The ace looked rumpled and tired, his impeccably tailored suit stained with sweat. Jay met his eyes. They were full of pain and shame, and something that might have been terror. He looked as though he was going to cry. When he raised a hand in a gesture that had grown all too familiar to Jay, and rubbed at something on the side of his neck. Ackroyd wanted to cry himself. Sasha stepped into view beside Hiram, his head moving slowly from side to side in tiny bird-like motions, as his telepathy tested the waters. It was safe. Sasha nodded.
"Open it."
Charm opened the suitcase. Inside was a young girl, no more than 4 or 5. She was tiny, fair-skinned, blonde, naked, and smiling. Clinging to her in an obscene embrace was a thing that looked like a cross between an aborted fetus and the biggest maggot Jay had ever seen. Its mouth was pressed to the side of her neck, and in the sudden quiet, Jay could hear faint sucking sounds. But its eyes were alive and alert. They found Jay in the darkness and considered him hungrily. "My nightmare," Jay thought wildly. He almost expected it to howl. Warmth spread across his thighs as his bladder let go.
"He is very afraid, Master," Sasha said.
"Later I will taste his fear," the little girl replied.
She climbed awkwardly from the suitcase and put a dainty hand on Charm to steady herself. She had a voice out of a Shirley Temple movie. But the words belonged to the thing on her back.
"Hiram,"
Jay pleaded.
"Do something."
"There is nothing to be done, Jay," Hiram Worcester said softly. "I'm sorry." Jay twisted helplessly against his bonds, trying to wrench his hands free. It was useless. He couldn't even feel his hands. For all he knew, they had fallen off an hour ago.
"They are strong, Master," Azili said.
"Both aces," Sasha confirmed.
Hiram looked as though he was going to say something. Instead, he turned to stare at a wall. Jay called out to him.
"Make a fucking fist, Hiram. These guys are nothing compared to you. Pile on the weight until the goddamn leech is a thin film on the floor."
"You don't understand," Hiram said. "T. Mellis is my master. I couldn't live without his kiss. How could I hurt him?" His huge body shook. "I could never hurt him."
"I will try the boy first,"
the little girl announced. If Blaze heard or understood, he gave no sign. They came into the room one by one, the girl first,
with the creature Hiram had called T-Malice glistening against her flesh. Then Sasha, Azili, the centipede, even Charm, and the others. Only Hiram remained back in the other room. Blaze stared up at them blankly, then seemed to wake, as if from a deep sleep.
No!
He shouted, scrambling back across the filthy mattress, as far from T-Malice as he could go. It wasn't far enough.
No! Please!
Interesting, the girl said. I can feel it touching the mount's mind. Trying to push her away.
Stunted vestigial limbs stirred feebly as T-Malice prepared to move to a new host.
Not the girl, Jay screamed. The thing on her back!
Blaze gave him one quick, desperate glance. And in that moment, Jay truly knew the meaning of fear.
Hold him for me,
T-Malice told Charm, with the mouth of its child. The huge joker shambled forward. The boy's violet eyes went back to T-Malice and narrowed in a last desperate act of courage as his mind reached out for the parasites. Then Blaze began to scream.
4 p.m. Brennan peered through the peephole when the doorbell rang. It was fade out, looking bothered and impatient. Brennan smiled and opened the door.
All right, Quinn,
Fadeout said as he stomped into the entranceway to the Magic Kingdom. What's all this about? His voice faded as he spotted Brennan standing before him, and so did he. But Brennan was ready. He slammed the door behind the ace, and as Fadeout disappeared, Brennan threw the contents of the metal canister he'd been holding right at him. A fine white powder fluffed out from the container, coating Fadeout from head to toe and sprinkling the floor all around him. Fadeout blinked astonished eyes and sneezed. His tongue came out and licked the corner of his mouth.
Jesus Christ, he exploded. That's cocaine.
Brennan nodded.
Do you know how much money you just threw at me? Jesus Christ, we're talking millions.
Brennan dropped the canister and drew and aimed his .38 right between Fadeout's eyes. We're talking dead, he said flatly. Fadeout backed away with enough white powder clinging to him to make him look a 6-foot-tall sugar donut.
You're angry,
he said to Brennan.
You're right, Brennan said. Calm me down.
What do you want?
Chrysalis's diary, Brennan gestured with his gun. Or your head, either one. I figure you read it already. I figure that I can find Deadhead somewhere. I figure he's hungry. Fadeout barely suppressed a shudder at the mention of Deadhead, the psychotic ace who could access people's memories by eating their brains.
Well, okay, I guess we can come to some kind of accommodation. It's at my apartment. We can go and pick it up.
You can call and have it delivered.
That's fine, too.
This way. Brennan gestured with his gun, and Fadeout walked ahead of him, slowly and carefully. In here, Brennan said. He led the way to Quinn's combination boudoir rumpus room, where Quinn himself was already installed in the chair that Brennan had once been held captive in.
Bummer,
Quinn said when they entered the room. He apparently was off his lewd low, and his brain was functioning somewhat normally. Fadeout fixed him with a steady glare.
We'll talk later,
Fadeout said. Sit there, Brennan ordered. Fadeout sat on a chair next to Quinn. Brennan tossed him a straitjacket he'd found among Quinn's collection of bondage devices. Fadeout slipped it on wordlessly, then Brennan awkwardly tied him into it. To make doubly sure, he further tied Fadeout into the chair using some leather restraints that were also part of the Eskimo's unusual collection. Now, about that call, Brennan said. Fadeout, who by now had given up all pretense at invisibility, grumbled, but did as he was told. Brennan sat and watched the two as they waited for the delivery to be made. Once or twice, Fadeout tried to start a conversation by offering apologies and excuses, but Brennan was having none of it. A look at his face was enough to shut Fadeout up. Finally, the doorbell rang, and Brennan went to answer it. A werewolf in a Mae West mask was at the door. He handed Brennan the leather-bound journal and looked at him expectantly.
That's it, Brennan told him. You're not a delivery boy. You don't get a tip. The disappointed werewolf went down the driveway as Brennan went back into Quinn's bedroom.
Well, it's been delivered, Fadeout said. How about letting us go?
Brennan turned to Quinn. You have servants?
Yeah, man. Sunday's their day off.
So they'll be back tomorrow? Quinn nodded. They'll let you loose then, he said, and turned to go.
Okay, by me, Quinn said. Guess I'll cook some acid and meditate on the lessons I learned today.
Fadeout, though, was not so phlegmatic.
Hey, cowboy, he called. Let me loose.
Brennan shook his head. Don't push it. You're lucky I'm not leaving you dead.
Come on,
Fadeout implored, but Brennan just kept walking.
You bastard!
Fadeout yelled, and then he broke into shrill, mocking laughter.
You think you're so damn smart. You'll see what good that stupid book does you.
Brennan kept walking and left the house, leaving his door open, hoping against all odds that some burglars would come by and empty it. He stopped before Fadeout's brand new BMW and decided to take it back to the city. He thought about Fadeout's mocking words as he hotwired the car, and his curiosity compelled him to open the journal. As he scanned the pages, he realized that in a sense Fadeout was right. There was not a single fact, a single piece of concrete data in the whole book. It was a personal journal where Chrysalis had kept her thoughts, where she wrote in clear, plain feeling words about her doubts, fears, and anxieties. Brennan turned to the entry for the day, well over a year and a half ago, when he had offered her his protection and love, and she turned him down. That was the last day he'd seen her alive.
What, she had written, am I so afraid of? I'm not afraid to show my hideous deformity to the world every day. In fact, I revel in the discomfort my appearance causes, in the revulsion it evokes. I have to live with it every day. So should everyone else. I make men make love to my ugliness as the price for the information they seek. Why can't I give myself to one who might love me for myself? Is it fear? Fear that he doesn't really care? That he's using me? That he'll drop me the moment he achieves all he wants? I'm such a coward. Goodbye, my archer. I shall miss you. I shall miss what might have been between us.
The journal hung loosely in Brennan's hands. He didn't want to read any more. He hadn't the right. No one had. He only skimmed the last few entries to make sure they contained nothing that could possibly relate to her death. Then he took the cigarette lighter out of Fadeout's brand new BMW and burned the journal to ashes there on Quinn's thick green lawn.
So fresh, Blaze said. Intense. Exquisite.
He was naked on the mattress, Azili spread out beneath him. Coca-colored thighs spread. Her legs locked around his waist as he thrust into her heat. She was covered with a fine dew of perspiration, and she screamed every time the boy pushed into her.
Slowly, my precious one, Blaze commanded.
But of course, it wasn't him at all. It was the creature that clung to him like a pale white leech. Its mouth pressed to his neck, its tiny eyes closed so it might better enjoy the sensations flooding through the boy's body.
This mount has never known a female, it said. It grows very excited. Slowly, Azili Jarouge, slowly.
Obediently, Azili slowed beneath them. She showed her teeth when she laughed.
I will make it last, she promised.
Her fingers reached up and played with the boy's nipples. Jay turned his face away from the tableau and found Hiram Worcester standing above him. The huge ace looked as anguished and helpless as Jay had ever seen him.
Untie me, Jay whispered. Now, while they're occupied.
Azili was screaming again, her voice husky with pleasure. For a long time, Hiram Worcester said nothing. There was only the wet, angry sound of flesh on flesh, and Charm's guttural singing from the next room. Finally, Hiram turned away and walked off without saying a word.
Now,
Timalis said in Blaze's voice.
The boy's body jerked in orgasm. Azili's legs tightened around him, and she laughed.
5 p.m. Jennifer was awake when Brenna returned to Father Squid's. She and the priest were playing chess. When she saw him, she stood and threw her arms around him and kissed him, then held him at arm's length.
Why did you let me sleep through all the excitement? You almost got yourself killed without me.
Almost, Brennan agreed. He threw himself down on the sofa and sighed deeply.
What's the matter?
Jennifer asked. Brennan shook his head. It's all gone. I've used up all the possible clues. There's nothing left to investigate. Bludgeon, Oddity, Worm, Morkel, Quasi-Man. None of them did it. Her journal was no help. Her files have been burned. Everything and everyone else has vanished into thin air. Sasha, Azili, her master. Jennifer sat down beside him and laid her hand on his cheek.
Is there no one else to question?
Father Squid asked. Brennan shook his head wearily. I don't think so, Father.
There's me,
a small voice peeped. Everyone turned to see one of the homunculi come out shyly from behind the couch.
How long have you been there?
Father Squid asked.
A while. I was watching. There is nothing else I can do.
Can you help? Brennan asked, desperate for any information. Have you heard of any of those names?
Azili,
the homunculus said.
I've heard that name.
Yeah, Brennan said. A lot of people have. Only no one knows where she is.
Perhaps she's at the loft.
Loft, Brennan said, suddenly sitting upright on the sofa.
Yes. When Sasha started acting strange, the lady wanted to know about the woman he was seen with. We followed her to a loft near the East River. Two of my brothers went there, but they never came back.
Do you remember this address? Brennan asked in a low voice.
I think so,
the homunculus said. Jennifer looked at Brennan.
You're not going alone this time, she said.
Brennan nodded. It was only a few hours until dark.
I'll make it get up and do a little dance,
Blaze had said when he'd first seen Charm in Piedmont Park. The memory had still been there, in the back of the boy's mind, and his master had found it and been amused. Charm had been dancing for almost 40 minutes now. One of the pairs of legs attached to the female body, in the middle, had stopped moving 20 minutes ago, but the rest of the joker continued its grotesque shuffle. When Charm finally collapsed in exhaustion, the huge body slumped against the couch, jolting it sideways, almost a foot. The silence that followed was profound and frightening. Sasha and the centipede man entered the room. Does it please you? Sasha asked.
Very much,
Team Alice replied through Blaze.
It feels intensely, and when its mind takes hold of another else, it feels the other's emotions, as well as the physical sensations. So much to savor, all at once. Flavors, colors, the textures of two or three bodies. Exquisite. A treasure,
Azili said. She sat on the mattress, one arm coiled around the boy's skinny leg. Both of them were still naked. His powers will be useful, Master, Sasha pointed out. Any mount you might desire is yours now. Even the most powerful of aces. The boy can bring them to you and hold them still, helpless, while you take them.
Yes, the creature had Blaze say. You have done well. You shall have the kiss soon, my dear one.
Sasha looked like a dog who'd just been thrown a Slim Jim.
This mount has known death. In a way, I have never tasted,
Blaze said for his master.
It has joined with the minds of the dying, tasted the sweet with the bitter, the killing with the dying, sipped at the darkness itself, yes.
Blaze turned slowly, studying the others in the basement. The thing that rode him opened its own pale, weak eyes.
Him,
the centipede man said eagerly. He pointed at Jay with half a dozen knives.
Kill him. He sent all your other mounts away, Master. He's dangerous.
Eyes fixed on Jay, blazes violet and strangely wide. His master's vague and frightening. Jay stared right back at him. Until Hiram stepped in the way.
No, he said. Not Jay. He's an ace.
Ackroyd is powerful, Sasha agreed. A projecting teleport. When he is yours, you can never be threatened again. He can point a finger and move you to safety whenever an enemy threatens.
That is good.
The eyes began to move again. They stopped on the centipede man. It took the Joker a long moment to realize what was happening.
No, Master, he said. Not me. I'm useful too.
Only a Joker, Azili said. He wanted to kill them both. Your new treasures.
I was afraid, the centipede said. They were aces, dangerous. I didn't want you hurt. No, please. I just didn't want you hurt, Master.
He wanted to keep your kiss for himself, Azili said.
In a moment, he's going to attack you with his knives, Sasha reported matter-of-factly. Blaze's eyes narrowed slightly. The knives clattered against the stone floor as they fell from limp fingers.
Hiram, do something, Jay said.
Hiram turned away. The human centipede stood immobile, his body frozen by the power of Blaze's mind. But the boy must have left him his mouth, because he was still begging.
No, please! Take one of the others!
He cried in that high, sharp voice.
Take the woman! Or the girl! Yes, take her! Or Charm, take Charm! He can't even talk! He's stupid! Take him! Please don't hurt me, Master. I love you.
Blaze! Jay screamed.
Let him go!
The boy didn't even turn his head. The centipede man reached over with a half dozen of his right hands and seized the uppermost of his left arms.
I love you, Master,
he whimpered.
I love you. I love you.
Then the words turned into a high, thin shriek of pain as he ripped the arm right off his body. Blood spurted.
He loves you, Azili said, smiling as the man's blood-soaked hands dropped the severed arm to the floor and seized the one below it.
The second arm didn't come off quite so cleanly. The man began to use his fingernails, tearing at his own flesh, with all the strength left in him. Hiram walked to a corner of the cellar and threw up. Jay couldn't watch. He looked at Blaze. There was a look in those dark eyes that Jay had never seen on a human face before. The boy's penis stirred slightly and began to rise until a monstrous erection was growing from the tangle of coppery red pubic hair. Azili noticed it too and covered it with her mouth. But when the Joker's second arm came off, she took her lips away from him just long enough to say,
He loves you not.
9 p.m. Someone had broken in here before. Brennan glanced at Jennifer, who was waiting below him on the rickety fire escape while he considered the bedroom window. One of his panes had been partially removed by a glass cutter. He took a deep breath and rested for a moment. His right arm, covered from wrist to elbow in a hard plastic cast, throbbed like hell. He'd been careful while climbing the fire escape, but he couldn't keep from banging it around a little. Brennan tried the window that opened into the second-story loft, above a closed-down printing company. It was unlocked. He took a deep breath, lifted the window, and entered the bedroom. It was dark and quiet. He motioned Jennifer to stay behind. She nodded, and Brennan went through the bedroom into a part of the loft that had been subdivided into a number of small rooms. He moved through the darkness, peering into them. They were mostly bedrooms, but one had been soundproofed and turned into a torture chamber. They were all empty.
A lavish kitchen was opposite the warren of rooms. A huge living area with white carpeting formed the other half of the loft. Brennan crept down the hallway and peered into the living area. It, too, seemed empty. He flicked on the light switch. The walls were covered with weird, painted designs. Brennan approached one to look at it more closely, and a hideous, flat flap of flesh rose into the air from where it had been resting out of sight on the sofa and swooped at him with the speed of a diving falcon. The Joker's face, located on his underside, was almost human, except for the male genitalia that hung below its pale green eyes. Brennan ducked, instinctively throwing his arm up to protect his face, and the Joker rammed it, sending a wave of agony lancing through his system. He fell and lost his gun. The thing made a tight turn and came back at Brennan again, its skin pale and pimpled, an erect spine from its underside pointing at Brennan like a lance. There was a loud explosion, reverberating endlessly in the living room, and the thing jerked away, keening a loud cry of anger and pain. Brennan glanced up the corridor at Jennifer, who was standing braced, her pistol out, and smoking. The manta ray Joker swooped at her like a spinning, rolling airplane, and she ghosted. It cut right through her and darted into the bedroom from which they'd entered. There was a crash of shattering glass as it broke through a window and escaped.
"What was that?"
Jennifer demanded in a shaking voice. "I don't know," Brennan said. "A guard?"
"Well, it didn't do a very good job," she said, coming down the corridor and helping Brennan to his feet.
Brennan recovered his gun and focused shakily on the designs painted on the walls of the living room. "What is that stuff?" he asked.
"Vave," Jennifer said. "Haitian religious designs, symbols of the Loas, the voodoo gods."
"I see," Brennan said. No, he didn't. He especially couldn't understand what any of this had to do with Chrysalis's death. He moved almost aimlessly through the living room, tired and numb with pain and failure.
"What should we look for?" Jennifer asked.
"Anything," Brennan said, in a voice with little hope. "Anything that might somehow shed light on these insane happenings. Anything that might lead us to Sasha." He opened a door and found himself staring in a hall closet that was jammed with clothing, mostly coats of all kinds, for both sexes and all sizes. The oddity, he remembered, had been looking through Chrysalis's bedroom closet, perhaps searching for the mysterious coat that had been mentioned in Chrysalis's will. "Give me a hand," he said over his shoulder to Jennifer. "Maybe there's something." He was reaching for a mink coat when he noticed a lightweight linen jacket dangling from the hook on the inside of the closet door. He took the jacket down instead, frowning as he looked at it. It was pure white linen, clean and spotless, except for an almost unnoticeable spray of bloodstains near the bottom edge. He stared at it for a long moment and then reached into his pockets. The left one was empty. The right one contained a pack of antique playing cards. He shuffled through it. The ace of spades was missing. He looked at Jennifer. The pain, weariness, and frustration was gone from his face. His eyes were hard, his voice soft and dangerous. "Chrysalis's killer," he said quietly, "is in Atlanta."
10 p.m. "Bring me my cloak," Blaze said. The boy's mouth still glistened from Azili's juices. Team Alice, his eyes alive and avid, clung to his neck, talking with his tongue. When it grew quiet, you could hear a faint sucking sound, like an infant nursing at its mother's tit. Hiram came forward with the cloak. It was heavy purple felt, the inside lined with black satin. He helped Blaze into it, fussing with the drape, the way he sometimes fussed with Jay's suits. The cloak was too long for Blaze. The end of it trailed in the dirt. Hiram made adjustments. Then he lifted the voluminous hood, pulling it forward over the boy's head, concealing the bright red hair and the thing riding on his back. With the ties knotted around his throat, his face shadowed, Blaze looked like a hunchback.
"I will ride this mount into the world," Team Alice announced through Blaze. "Azili, you will accompany me. Dress."
Azili rose from the mattress, sleek and lazy as a cat.
Her smooth coffee-colored skin was still spattered with blood. She saw Jay watching her, smiled, and ran a tongue across her lips as she bent to pick up her dress.
Hiram, Jay said, begging. Please.
The thought of Blaze wandering through the streets of Atlanta, with his awesome mind-control powers at the disposal of Team Alice, frightened him witless.
You don't realize how powerful Blaze is. You don't know what you're turning loose.
Azealia laughed as she slipped into her dress, pulled it down around her breasts.
Are you sure of that, little one?
Hiram didn't hear a word.
When will you return?
When I grow bored with the new mount,
Team Alice replied in the boy's familiar voice. Blaze reached up, touched Hiram's beard, gently stroked his cheek.
You shall not want for my kiss, he promised.
Hiram smiled.
What about Aykroyd, Master? Sasha asked.
Blaze turned his body. The boy's violet eyes stared at Jay, and he could almost feel the other eyes on him. The ones hidden in the blackness beneath the hood.
I will try the other mount when I return, Blaze said. Keep it safe for me.
Jay tried once more.
Hiram!
He yelled. Hiram opened the cellar door. Blaze swirled his cloak around him as he turned and climbed up into the Atlanta night. Monday, July 25th, 1988. 4 a.m. The nightmare came again. The woods, the steps, the cone-faced thing turning, turning. Jay woke in darkness, screaming.
Jay, a deep voice asked, are you all right?
Dimly, through the dark of the cellar, he could see Hiram looming above him, a vast shadow. Jay struggled against his bonds, gave it up, slumped back with a groan.
No,
he said in a hoarse whisper. Team Alice had been gone for hours. I'm not all right. I'm tied up in this stinking cellar. I had to watch some poor bastard rip himself apart with his bare hands. Blaze is out doing God knows what, and in a little while, a giant maggot is going to fasten itself to my neck and suck my blood. So no, I am not all right! Somewhere in the middle of that, Jay's whisper had turned into a scream. He heard Charm stir, woken from sleep. Then the Joker began to sing The House of the Rising Sun. It was just what Jay needed. Hiram sat on the corner of the old sofa, shoulders slumped.
I'm sorry, he said weakly. If there's anything I can do...
You can untie me, Jay said quickly.
Sasha would know. The moment I'd begun,
Hiram said helplessly.
So? Jay said. What's Sasha going to do? Charm's strong, but you're an ace, damn it. You can handle him. This is the best chance we're going to get. Once my hands are free...
I can't, Jay, Hiram said, cutting him off in a voice thick with despair.
I would if I could, but Jay, I'm sorry. I never meant for any of this to happen. You have to believe that.
I believe it, Jay said gently. Hiram sounded weary and heartsick and full of pain. There was a long silence.
How long? Jay finally asked.
A year and a half, Hiram replied.
It happened on the tour. In Haiti. Azealia was his lure. I deluded myself into thinking I was seducing her. But of course, it was the other way around. Afterward, when I dozed off, she opened the door, and the master took me in my sleep. Once I was his, he used me to smuggle him into the United States. I had money, influence. It wasn't difficult at all.
This is your chance to break free, Jay urged.
Use it.
It's been the ruin of many a poor boy, Charm sang softly. And me, by God, I'm one. Hiram could not look at him. He shook his head.
Untie me, Jay whispered. That's all you need to do. Simple. I'll handle the rest. Just get my hands free. You don't even have to watch. I'll pop you to the Jokertown Clinic. You can get treatment for whatever he's done to you. Do it now, Hiram. We don't know how much time we have left.
You'd hurt him, Hiram said. His voice broke. You don't understand. His kiss, it's like... words can't describe it, Jay. When you're part of him, it's as though you're alive for the first time in your life. You feel such intense pleasure. Food, drink, sex, even the simple act of breathing, it all becomes intoxicating. But when he leaves you, when he moves to another mount, that's like dying, Jay. The world turns gray, and after a week or so, the physical withdrawal sets in. You can't imagine the pain. You crave him. It's a hunger. And if it's not fed... He looked up, his eyes imploring understanding. Besides, he's not evil. Not the way you and I understand it. Without his mounts, he'd die. He needs us, just as we need him. It's just that his morality is different than ours. In New York, Jay said, after Sasha had run to Atlanta with your little pal, I found a torture chamber in his apartment. Not to mention a body in his bathroom. Yes, Hiram said. He looked away again. A mount. One of the jokers. His voice was so low that Jay could barely hear it over Charm's singing. Sometimes, pain is different from pleasure, he says. But just as interesting. The sensations of death are... Especially... I got it. He tortures his more expendable mounts to death to get a few jollies, right? But he's not bad. Just misunderstood, he snorted. Hiram, that thing defines evil. For a long time, Hiram Worcester said nothing. There was only Charm's guttural singing from the next room, but finally Hiram's lips moved, so weakly that Jay did not catch the words. What? He whispered. Hiram turned his head. Foul. Oh, God, Jay. You don't know what it's been like. So many times, I just wish for it to be over. That he'd kill me the next time. But I'm too powerful, you see. I'm an ace. He wants aces. Wants the powers. I'll never be free. And you? It'll be the same. No way, Jay said. Hiram, don't let him take me. I can't hurt him. I told you. Then hurt me, Jay said. Kill me. If it comes to that, but don't let him take me. He never thought he'd hear himself beg for death, but his flesh was crawling at the very thought of T-Malice. It would be like his nightmare, but this time he would never wake. This time it would go on and on, forever. Hiram Worcester stared at him with sudden wonder on his broad face. Kill you? He murmured. His fingers flexed, closing slowly into a fist, then opening again. He would be angry, Jay. So very angry. You can't imagine. Perhaps then he might... free me? Jay knew what he meant by free.
7 a.m. They waited at the airport all night for the first available flight to Atlanta. Jennifer fell asleep around midnight, but Brennan could not. He sat up all night meditating on a playing card an ace of spades left him in a will. When it was time to board the flight, he slipped it into the breast pocket of his denim jacket where it would be close at hand.
9 a.m. When the door opened, Jay caught a brief glimpse of pale, thin sunlight filtering down from above. Blaze stepped into the cellar, stumbling on the last step, almost tripping over the end of his cloak. The boy looked dead on his feet, his face drawn and pale. He'd been ridden to exhaustion and beyond. Sasha stepped forward to remove the heavy felt cloak. "We were concerned for you, Master," he said as he undid the ties. "We heard sirens, screams in the night." Izili laughed from the doorway. "The night was magic, Sasha," she said, running a tongue across her lower lip. "Hartman went mad. We watched it on the television. A circus of blood. Then the Jokers went mad, too. We wandered in the park and played with them all night long. No one noticed." She shut the cellar door behind her, and darkness resumed its reign.
"This mount is tired,"
Team Alice announced in Blaze's hoarse, weary tones.
"It is time to tie the other. Bring it."
Everyone looked at Jay. Sasha folded the cloak, set it aside, turned his face toward Jay. There might have been pity in his eyes, if he'd had eyes. He nodded a charm, and the huge Joker shambled forward.
"Can't we talk this over?" Jay asked.
Charm ignored him. Hands grasped his legs, shoulders, feet, and jerked him into the air. Charm flung him over a shoulder, carried him across the cellar. The place still smelled like a butcher shop. Flies swarmed around decaying pieces of human flesh. Charm tossed Jay down on the mattress. Izili bent over him and kissed him lightly, her lips wet and hot.
"Soon," she said.
"Prepare it for me,"
Blaze's voice commanded. Charm grabbed a handful of Jay's shirt and yanked sharply. The fabric tore with a loud ripping sound until it got tangled in the jacket.
"Its bonds are in the way,"
Team Alice noticed.
"Untie it. Strip it."
"Master," Sasha cautioned. "He is dangerous when his hands are free."
"I can't even feel my fucking hands," Jay complained. He tried not to think about what he was thinking about.
Sasha picked right up on the thought he was trying not to think. "He thinks he'll have a chance once he's untied."
"Is it afraid?"
Team Alice asked.
"Of you, very much. Of being a mount. And there is some other fear. An older fear."
The telepath frowned. "A dream he's had. You remind him of this nightmare, Master."
"Free its hands," Team Alice said. "This young mount has the power to hold it still."
Charm turned him over, slammed him down into the mattress, and pinned him with a boot while hands fumbled behind his back. Jay's wrists had been bound for so long he couldn't feel any difference when they were free. Charm kicked roughly at one arm, and it fell heavily to the side. His shoulder shrieked with pain. "Roll over and get the hand up," he thought. But Charm was pressing down on him. He couldn't move. Then something else grabbed him, something stronger and harder and more powerful than Charm's twisted body would ever be. Blaze's mind. The foot went away. Jay stirred. But it was Team Alice who moved his arms through Blaze. When he rolled over, they were right there, kneeling beside him on the mattress. The boy was still smiling. His master peered over one bare, bruised shoulder. Jay could hear the faint sucking sound, could see the boy's blood pulsing through pale, translucent veins in the creature's glistening flesh. The boy spoke.
"Strip him."
Charm peeled the jacket off Jay's back. It was damp with sweat and spatters of blood. The Joker ripped away his shirt. Now he was bare-chested, his throat and neck exposed to the demon's kiss.
"He's trembling,"
Azili said,
trembling for the kiss.
Jay felt a faint tingling in his hands. He tried to move them, to make a gun, to point. He couldn't move. Blaze's power and his master's will held him perfectly still. Jay's eyes flicked down to his hands. They were pale, bloodless, his wrists bruised and purple. He looked like he was wearing fishbelly gloves, and there were dark red lines in his skin where the wires had cut deep. He tried to flex his fingers, make the feeling come back. Nothing.
Master, Hiram said.
He stepped out of the corner, looming over the mattress behind them, his shadow almost as huge as Charm's. T'Malis looked at him with Blaze's eyes. But Jay couldn't even turn his head. He felt Hiram's presence more than he saw it. His hands were full of pins and needles as his circulation returned.
Master,
Hiram repeated. He sounded frightened.
Please,
let this one go.
Why?
T'Malis wanted to know. The tingling in Jay's hands had begun to turn to pain. The pins and needles were replaced by knives and pincers. He gasped in sudden pain, and the noise made him realize he still had control of his voice. Of course, he thought. Like the centipede man.
T'Malis liked to hear them beg.
He is a friend, Hiram said. I've never asked you for anything before.
Please.
T'Malis turned to Sasha.
What will you do if I take this new mount?
The telepath turned his head toward Hiram. Nothing, he reported after a moment. He could never hurt you. T'Malis turned back to Jay as if Hiram Worcester no longer existed.
Down,
he said. Jay lay down on his side so his master would have easy access to his back and his neck. Blaze stretched out beside him on the mattress. He was so close Jay could smell Azili on him, close enough for their bare chests to touch lightly, close enough for a kiss. His hands were on fire, the blood rushing through his fingers like white-hot wires. It was an effort not to faint. T'Malis pulled his mouth away from the boy's neck with a soft, wet sound. The creature began to wriggle up and over Blaze's shoulder, toward Jay. Its own limbs were stunted. It writhed forward like some huge worm. An inch at a time, tiny three-fingered hands grasping feebly at the boy's flesh for purchase. Blood trickled weakly from a ragged hole it had left behind. Jay forced his eyes away from the horror coming toward him and looked into the boy's eyes. Blaze seemed dazed, lost, and Jay remembered what Hiram had said. When he leaves you, it's like dying. Blaze, he said urgently, let me go. Those deep violet eyes blinked once. Twice, tried to focus.
He,
Blaze said. It was his own voice, his own words, and for a split second, Jay dared to hope.
He said, hold you.
He felt the cold, wet touch of T'Malis's flesh on his own, as the thing's withered hand pulled at a shoulder. Don't look, Jay told himself. Like in the dream. Don't ever look up at the moon. If you do, you're lost. He had dreamed that dream 1,000 times. He knew better than to look. He looked. The creature's mouth was round, like the mouth of a fish. And as it slid forward in jerks and starts, its tongue moved in and out. Its tongue was round, too, flushed with blood. Red and glistening, like some obscene blind snake. Its eyes were wise and cruel and terrible. Blaze was fucking hopeless.
Hiram!
Jay screamed. Hiram's voice came from a long way away.
I can't hurt him.
T'Malice's atrophied legs kicked feebly at Blaze's face as it moved off the boy and onto Jay. It must have kicked too hard. Blaze winced. For a moment, Jay felt his fingers flex. The thing was crawling across him, his flesh crawling beneath it. But there was something important.
Shit, Jay said.
Master! Sasha cried out in alarm. Jay drowned out his warning with a shout.
Hiram!
He screamed.
Hurt Blaze, damn it! Hurt Blaze!
Hiram kicked the boy in the head. Jarm was stumbling forward, Azili, Sasha. But they were all late. Too late. Jay had his body back. He rolled to one side and came down flat on his back, with T'Malice clinging to his chest, thrashing as frantically as a worm impaled on a hook. His hand came up, but his fingers were like wood. T'Malice slithered up his chest, looking straight down into his eyes. Jay folded back three fingers, stuck one out, lifted his thumb, tried to point. His hand was shaking. The blind snake came coiling out. Jay stuck a shaking finger into T'Malice's eye. There was a short, crisp pop. Jay felt a sharp pain, and blood began to spurt from the hole in his neck. But he hardly noticed. The weight was off his chest. Azili screamed.
Oh, God!
Sasha said. Blaze began to weep uncontrollably. And behind him, he heard Hiram Worcester say very softly, It's over.
10 a.m. The Atlanta airport was crowded with weary delegates heading for home, still buzzing about a convention that no one was ever likely to forget. Brennan pushed through them, uncaring and unseeing, with Jennifer in his wake. They didn't even stop to join the crowd watching a midget being cut out of a cat carrying case. He staggered out, rumpled and red-eyed, croaking, Water! Water! They were nearing the end of the line, but Brennan was feeling no elation. His anesthesia-provoked dream of the night before was still vivid in his mind. Intellectually, he didn't blame himself for Chrysalis's death, but he realized that emotionally, he did. He remembered the line from Tachyon's eulogy about the harsh expectations Chrysalis's ghost would have. But he knew that Chrysalis's ghost wasn't driving him. It was his own savage ghost, fueled by his unrelenting memories of her. He wondered if he'd ever be able to lay her to rest. They caught a cab downtown and stopped at a pawn shop to buy two guns, a Walther PPK automatic for Brennan and a Smith & Wesson 38 Chief Special for Jennifer. He paid cash. The proprietor didn't ask any questions.
Noon. The hospital wanted to admit all three of them, but Jay was having none of it. He hung around just long enough to answer a few questions, cadge a fresh supply of painkillers, and make sure they were going to take good care of Blaze. Then he grabbed Hiram and had the nurse phone for a cab. The cellar of the burned-out ruin, where T'Malice had set up housekeeping, was almost an hour's ride from the center of Atlanta. Hiram stared vacantly out the window as they drove. Every now and then, he had a fit of uncontrollable trembling, and a look of panic came into his eyes. I'm all alone now, he said once. Jay didn't reply. Conversation would have required more energy than he had right now. He stretched out and closed his eyes. The next thing he knew, Hiram was prodding him gently in the ribs. We're here, he said. Jay sat up groggily, fumbled for his wallet. It was empty. I've paid the fare already, Hiram said. He helped Jay out of the taxi and into the hotel. An alarm was screeching in the Marriott lobby. One of the elevators was stuck between floors. Jay winced. His headache was already a blinding band of pain behind his eyes. The noise was the last thing he needed. He jabbed at the call button savagely, and they took a different elevator up to Tachyon's floor. Jay unlocked the suite with Blaze's key, turned on the lights, and went to the bar to mix himself a stiff one. Hiram poked his head into the bedroom.
Tachyon?
He called out. There was no answer. He's not here, Hiram said, returning to the living room. Yeah, Jay said. I figured. He sat down to wait. Hiram moved to the bar and looked at the bottles, but made no move to mix himself a drink. He just stood there, staring, like a big lost child. Then he started to tidy up. He rinsed out a couple of dirty glasses, picked up an ashtray full of cigarette butts, looked around for a place to dump it. There was a jar full of ashes sitting on the bar, next to the liquor. Hiram peered into it curiously for a moment, shrugged, and dumped the butts in there. They both turned at the sound of the door opening. Dr. Tachyon sat in a wheelchair, his bandaged stump cradled in his lap. Behind him, pushing the chair, was Jack Braun. You, Braun said, glaring at Jay. We've been turning over half the city looking for you. Where the hell have you been? Jay, hide him, Tachyon said. He started to rise from the wheelchair. What's happened? Where's Blaze? The hospital, Jay admitted. Tachyon made a choking sound. Is he all right? He has a small fracture of the skull, and he's lost a few teeth, plus some bruises and abrasions, and a bad case of shock. But the doctors figure he's going to be okay. The hospital wanted to keep him under observation for a few days, that's all. Tachyon staggered, as if Jay's words were a physical blow. Jack Braun clouded up like a thunderhead and came storming forward. You goddamn jerk! He's only a kid! What the hell did you think you were doing, dragging him into some sleazy... Jay pointed. Jack popped. Maybe Braun finished his thoughts center stage at Freakers. Then again, maybe not. Sorry, Jay mumbled to Tachyon. My head's about to split open and hatch. I just can't take any more right now. Should you be out of that wheelchair? It was Jack's idea, Tachyon said. Jay could see how weak the little man still was. When he stumbled, he put out a hand to steady himself. But there was no hand there. His bandaged stump fetched up hard against the back of the sofa, and Tachyon gasped. Sit down, Jay said. Tachyon sat back down in the wheelchair, cradling his stump in his lap. Jay turned back to the bar. What are you doing? Tack asked. Pouring you a drink, Jay said. You're going to need one. He filled a second tumbler up with bourbon and ice cubes, brought it to Tachyon, and put it into his unresisting left hand. I don't drink bourbon, Tack said. Drink it, Jay said. Tachyon drank it, his pale lilac eyes full of dread. Tell me, he said when the glass was half empty. Jay told him all of it. To his credit, the alien listened without interrupting. Tears began to roll down his cheeks when Jay reached the part about the centipede man. But still, he held his tongue. Once T. Malice was gone, the fight went out of the mounts. Azili pitched a screaming fit, and the other woman, the girl with the baby, made a break for it. The rest just gaped at us. It was like they couldn't quite comprehend what was happening. I was going to call the cops, but Hiram stopped me. Hide him, Tack said, looking over at the big ace. Hiram nodded ponderously, as if his head were almost too heavy to move. We had all done vile things, myself included. What purpose would be served by imprisoning the mounts? We were only his instruments, his hands, his mouth, his eyes. It was Team Alice who murdered, not your grandson. I told Jay there was no sense in bringing Blaze to trial. The real murderer was already gone. And the rest of them, were they any different? You knew Sasha long before Team Alice took him, Doctor. He was never an evil man. Azili was the worst. But even there, how much was Azili and how much was the Master? She had been his prized mount her entire life. They're all going to be living in hell anyway, Jay said. With me, Hiram added darkly. Tack looked from one to the other. Without the kiss. Hiram nodded. You cannot imagine. Oh, Hiram, Tachyon said, his voice thick with pity for his old friend. You should have come to me. There are a lot of things I should have done, Hiram said. Anyway, Jay said, I let the mounts go.
All of them?
Tachyon said, astonished. I didn't figure I had the right to pick and choose, Jay said. Charm was the only one I thought twice about. He was the one who killed Chrysalis.
Charm? Tachyon said. But why?
Chrysalis knew everything about everybody. Team Alice depended on secrecy for safety. Exposed, he was pitifully vulnerable. She must have found out about him somehow. But what she didn't know was that Sasha was already his. The way I figure, her trusted telepath told his master that Chrysalis was getting close, so Team Alice sent Charm to take her out. It adds up. The killer had to be someone Sasha knew. Otherwise, he would never have gotten inside the palace without being detected. Maybe Team Alice rode Charm personally that morning to experience the sensation of beating someone to death. Or maybe not. I don't suppose we'll ever know.
All this time searching for the man who killed Chrysalis, Tachyon murmured softly. And yet, you choose to let him go.
Charm's fucked up enough, Jay said. Besides, it wasn't Charm. It was Team Alice, and Team Alice is gone. Dr. Tachyon sipped from his drink and thought about that for a long time. Finally, the alien gave a short, curt nod.
So much blood, he said. So much killing. It has to stop, Jay.
Yeah, Jay said. Maybe Barnett is right. No, Tack said. Hiram Worcester stood up suddenly. I should go. I have to pack. Check out. His voice trailed off.
Of course, Tachyon said.
Go on, Jay told him. I'll come down in a minute. Hiram nodded and stepped out into the hall. When the door closed behind him, Ackroyd turned back to Tachyon. He's going to need your help, Doc. He's an addict. And from what he says, the kiss is 100 times more addictive than heroin.
Hiram will have all the help he requires, Tachyon said. I owe him a debt I can never repay. A blood debt. My grandson's life.
The alien shook his head.
I could have helped him, he said plaintively. Why didn't he tell me?
There's a better question. You're supposed to be Hiram's friend.
So am I.
So how come all this time we never noticed that anything was wrong? Dr. Tachyon just looked at him. Tears welled up in his eyes. And behind them, guilt.
Shit, Jay said.
He was tired of tears. Tired of guilt and shame and fear and pain. Just forget it, okay? There's nothing we can do about it except try to get him through. Hiram used all the strength he had left in him to kick your grandson in the head. He's going to need us.
Then we must not fail him, Tachyon said.
Jay nodded. Suddenly he felt very weary. I better go down and keep Hiram company, he said. He's still pretty shaky.
Of course, Tachyon said. But when Jay opened the door, Hiram was right there, in the hall. His huge body was trembling, and he looked up at Jay from forlorn eyes.
Hiram, what's wrong? Jay asked.
It's nothing, Hiram began. I suppose an anxiety attack?
He blinked, as if to clear his head.
Jay, if you wouldn't mind, could you come down to the room with me? It's just that I would rather not be alone right now. Can you understand that?
Jay nodded, as he took Hiram by the arm. Dr. Tachyon rose unsteadily from his wheelchair.
We'll both go, the little alien announced in a tone that brooked no dissent.
Hiram looked at them both gratefully. Jay figured they must have made quite a sight as they limped off together. While they waited for the elevator to arrive, Tachyon turned back to Jay.
One thing, he asked. You never said where you teleported Team Malice.
Funny thing about that, Jay said. The way my power works, I have to visualize a place real good before I can teleport anyone there. I have to be able to get a clear picture in my head, really see it in my mind's eye. I got a bunch of places like that, places I know inside and out. Sometimes it's just reflex. I don't have time to think about what I'm doing or where I'm going to send someone. I just point, and they wind up the first place that pops into my head.
Yes, Tachyon said politely.
I made a lot of phone calls from the hospital. Team Alice hasn't shown up in any of my usual places. Somehow, though, I didn't think he would. I looked right into that son of a bitch's face when he was crawling toward me. And the only thing that popped into my mind was this nightmare I've been having since I was a kid. Jay coughed apologetically.
I know that place real well, he said.
So you figure it out.
Dr. Tachyon thought about it for a moment. There was the sound of a chime. The elevator doors opened. Tack nodded slowly to Jay, turned, and entered the car.
1 p.m. Brennan heard the outer door to the suite open, tired voices, then the door close. He stood up, framed in the doorway leading into the bedroom portion of the suite, gun in hand. Tachyon, Aykroyd, and Worcester stood clumped together, astonishment on their faces as they saw Brennan.
Daniel, what are you doing here?
Brennan knew that Tachyon had lost a hand, but that knowledge didn't prepare him for the pale, drawn, bedraggled figure before him. Tachyon had obviously been through a lot the past week, but, Brennan thought grimly, it wasn't quite over yet. Tracking Chrysalis's killer, Brennan said grimly. Tachyon's bloodshot eyes went wide with astonishment.
Surely.
What the hell are you talking about? Aykroyd interrupted. He looked a little worse for wear himself. His face was puffy and bruised, and he seemed to be favoring one side. Brennan shook his head and gestured with his gun. Sit on the bed, he said in a cold voice, and I'll tell you a story about a murder. Hiram hung back for a moment, then did as Brennan ordered. Aykroyd sat down next to Worcester and kept his hands carefully in his lap.
Oh, God, Hiram moaned. Will this never end? Let's give him a chance,
Tachyon said.
Why?
Aykroyd asked truculently. Because I know who killed Chrysalis, Brennan said softly. Aykroyd frowned.
It was Malice's Joker goon. Chrysalis had discovered him.
No, it wasn't. Brennan took a deep breath so that he could speak in a calm, even voice.
I was Chrysalis's lover, he said.
Perhaps even her friend. That alone might have brought me back to track down her killer. But the murderer added insult to that injury. He tried to frame me for her death. He stared unblinkingly at Aykroyd.
Even you admit that was a clumsy job.
Aykroyd nodded reluctantly.
Yeah, you had me going for a while,
but it didn't take me long to realize it was a setup.
Brennan nodded, switched his gaze to Tachyon.
I had no idea why Chrysalis had been killed. Any number of things could have triggered the murder. I couldn't isolate the motive, so I concentrated on finding an ace strong enough to crush Chrysalis. But that, too, proved to be a blind alley, because Chrysalis wasn't killed by an ace with super strength.
What? Eckhart said. That's ridiculous.
Brennan shook his head. I knew something was wrong at the crime scene when I first saw it, but it took me a while to figure it out. There was very little blood in Chrysalis's office. She'd been killed before being pulped. Her heart had stopped pumping, so there was no blood sprayed on the walls, desk, or floor.
Tachyon nodded. That makes sense.
Someone was covering his tracks again, pretending the Chrysalis had been battered to death by an ace with extraordinary strength. But who?
Brennan shook his head.
The list of suspects had again become endless. But I thought I could narrow it down by questioning Sasha. He was a telepath. He'd been on the murder scene, and he was acting peculiar. I figured he knew more than he was admitting. He disappeared, but I thought I could track him down.
You couldn't have found him, Eichhorst said. He was here in Atlanta.
That's right, Brennan agreed. But during the investigation, I found out that he was enthralled to a mysterious master, someone called T. Malice. Then I found Malice's apartment, and in the apartment was a closet, and in the closet was a coat, and in the coat were these. He carefully reached into his hip pocket with his broken arm and took out a deck of playing cards. They were ornate, but worn and tattered, and of great age and apparent delicacy.
So what?
Aykroyd asked with a frown.
These are the cards, Brennan explained, the Chrysalis played solitaire with, the deck from which the murderer took the ace of spades to frame me.
The deck he then absentmindedly put in his coat pocket and took with him after he left her office.
Isn't that right, Worcester?
Brennan stared grimly at the huge ace. Hiram tried to speak, but no words would come out. He stuttered, sputtered, and fingered the angry sore on the side of his neck. His face pale and beaded with sweat, his hands trembling.
Brennan dropped the cards on the floor and took from his jacket pocket the ace of spades the Chrysalis had left him in her will. He scaled it at Hiram.
The card flew true, struck Hiram's broad chest, and tumbled to the floor where it landed face up, black and ominous, against the carpet.
Cute, Jay said as the card fluttered to the floor at Hiram's feet. That mean you're going to start killing people now, or what? He started to get up.
I told you not to move. The barrel of Brennan's automatic slid a few inches to the right, until it was fixed on Jay.
So shoot me, Jay said.
He got to his feet, looking right at Yeoman.
You got any idea what Hiram has just been through?
I don't care what he's been through.
Aren't you the fucking soul of compassion? Jay said.
I don't waste my compassion on killers, Brennan said.
Oh, I forgot. Your mother Teresa,
Jay said with bitter sarcasm.
Well, pardon the hell out of me. Thing of it is, though, seeing as how you hate killers so much, I can't help noticing you're the only one in the room with a gun in his hand.
Jay, Daniel, please. Tachyon pleaded. His good hand cradled his bandaged stump, and he sounded weak and sick at heart. Can't we work this out like civilized people?
He's trying to protect the killer, Yeoman said icily.
You got a hell of a lot of nerve calling anyone a killer, Danny boy, Jay snapped back.
This isn't about me, Yeoman said.
Stop it, Tachyon cried. He looked over at Brennan.
Daniel, there must be some mistake. I know Hiram Worcester. I have known him for close on 2 decades now. In good times and bad, he is a good man. Even if I believed for a moment that Hiram was capable of such an act. He was here in Atlanta at the convention while Chrysalis was being murdered in Jokertown. He couldn't have done it.
Jay glanced back at Hiram, uncomfortably.
Well, he admitted, with vast reluctance, that's not Quite true. I checked the airline schedules. If he took the last flight out and the first flight back, he'd never have been missed. But Carnifex could have caught the same flights. Same for Braun, or any of them.
That can easily be verified, Tachyon pointed out. Even if Hyrum used an assumed name, a man of his size would have been noticed.
Then check if that's what it takes to convince you, Brennan said. I have all the proof I need.
What about motive? Jay demanded. Or don't you bother with things like that? Motives, chains of evidence, courtrooms. What a fucking nuisance, right?
Your way is a lot simpler.
Danny Brennan says he's guilty. Time to kill the poor bastard.
I have evidence, Brennan replied curtly. Enough to convince me that it's true.
As far as I can see, you don't have jack shit, except for a deck of cards you found in some coat pocket, Jay said.
Jay makes a good point, Tachyon put in. Do you have any proof that Hyrum brought the cards to this apartment?
The kitchen cabinets were full of expensive gourmet foods. There was every kind of utensil you can imagine. Everything a gourmet cook like Worcester would need. And the jacket was white linen, expensive, fashionable, custom-tailored, size 68 long. Chrysalis was killed by an ace. How many aces wear that size?
Silence filled the room.
Jay turned to look behind him. Hyrum still sat on the corner of the bed. He was not using his gravity power. The mattress tilted ominously under his massive weight. His face was pale and damp. His shoulders slumped. His eyes still fixed on the ace of spades that lay at his feet. The stillness lasted an eon. All three of them were looking at Hyrum now. The big ace seemed oblivious until Tachyon finally softly said, "Hyrum." Then he looked up and sighed hugely. His eyes were sad and sick.
"Yes, doctor," he asked. "Are you all right?"
Tack asked gently.
"No," Hyrum said. "I haven't been all right for some time."
"This is crazy," Jay said. "Hyrum, don't just sit there. Tell him that he's wrong."
"I wish I could," Hyrum said with quiet dignity. "You don't know how much I wish that."
"What are you saying?" Tachyon asked, dread in his voice. "You don't mean to say that these accusations are true?"
Hyrum nodded, his eyes far off and full of pain. The big man seemed to be having trouble speaking.
I'm sorry."
Then it was Jay who had no words.
"There must be some explanation," Tachyon said. "I cannot accept this.
You're a good man, a man of courage and integrity."
"T. Malice," Jay blurted, "that fucking thing was riding you, using you, your powers, your body."
He swung around to face Brennan.
"You don't understand the situation. Hyrum was a victim. Even if he did do it, he was only the instrument."
"No, Jay," Hyrum interrupted quietly. "I appreciate your loyalty, but it wasn't like that. It was me. Just me. God help me."
He fell silent again, eyes turned inward.
"Hyrum, tell us," Tachyon implored.
For a moment, Hyrum didn't seem to hear. Then the big ace began to speak. His voice was weary, so quiet they had to strain to hear.
"I needed the kiss," he began simply.
"That was why I flew back to New York that night. The last flight out, just as Jay surmised. You don't know what it was like to go without the kiss. I needed it badly. So I flew back up and went to him secretly. There were always other mounts about. Team Alice was never alone. When I arrived, he was mounted on Sasha. But my master was pleased to see me. He left Sasha and gave me his kiss. That was when Sasha told me. He was angry. It was an act of spite. I had taken Team Alice away from him, you see. And there's nothing so awful in the world. He wanted to hurt me. So he told me that Chrysalis had hired a man to assassinate Greg Hartman. He knew how hard I'd worked. How much hope and faith and trust I'd put in Greg. Sasha had picked it out of her mind just that morning. He was only a skimmer, you know. The poorest kind of telepath. But her plan must have been right there on the surface of her mind. It didn't bother me. Not then. When Team Alice honors you with his kiss, everything seems just as it should be. And nothing can bother you. But after a few hours, the master bestowed his kiss on Izili, leaving me alone again. That was when I finally grasped what Sasha had said. I couldn't believe it. It seemed so monstrous, so obscene. I knew Chrysalis, not well, but I knew her. We'd spent 5 months together, on the stacked deck. I couldn't believe she would do such a thing. I had to confront her. I dressed and went down to the Crystal Palace. She was alone in her office, playing solitaire. You have to believe me, I never intended to hurt her. I told her what I'd heard, demanded to know if it was true. She didn't deny it. She didn't say anything. She looked up at me once, suspiciously, then went right back to playing solitaire. When I pressed her, all I got were evasive, meaningless answers in that infuriating fake accent of hers. If only she'd talked to me, told me what she knew about Greg, what she'd seen, perhaps I would have believed her at first. But I would have listened. Dear God, why wouldn't she talk to me? She didn't trust you, Hiram, Jay said, with a sad certainty. That was how she was. She didn't trust anybody. I tried to make her see how important it was. What a good man Greg was. Hiram laughed bitterly. I talked about his principles, his courage, his commitment to all of us, jokers and aces alike. How he was our last hope. Dear God, what a fool she must have thought me. I begged her. Tears were running down Hiram's face. If it was true, what Sasha had said, I begged her to call it off. And all the time, she just played cards. Turning them over one by one, putting them down in place. They made a little snapping noise when she flipped them off the deck. I remember, black on red, red on black, her face like a skull. I couldn't tell what she was thinking. She reminded me of death, sitting there playing cards while her hired assassin went out to do her killing for her. By what right? I asked her that, and she had no answer. I was very angry then. I made accusations, threats, told her I would go to the police. She just looked up and said that I'd do no such thing, that she knew a few things about me, too, and I knew she was talking about Team Alice. Then she told me to get out. I refused. I begged her to talk to me, to listen to me. She just laughed, started to get out of her chair. That was when his voice trailed off. Hiram Worcester looked down dully at his hands, resting on his knees. The fingers of his right hand closed slowly into a fist, then opened again, just as slowly.
I tried to make her sit back down, he said, his voice a hoarse whisper. I just wanted to talk to her. That's all. I swear it. She was just going to walk out on me, and I couldn't stand it. So I made a fist and tried to slam her back down into her chair. I'd done it dozens of times. Hundreds. Just hold her there with my power. That's all I wanted to do. Make her talk to me. Make her tell me the truth. Tell me who the assassin was. So we could stop him. I just wanted to make her sit down and listen. But
Hiram broke down, choking on his own words, his immense body shaking with dry sobs. But Jay didn't need to hear any more. He remembered Chrysalis, as he had found her. Her chair splintered beneath her, her bones shattered. He could imagine the rest. A fist closed in fury, a mind blinded by rage. How much had she weighed in that second? 1,000 pounds? 2,000? You left out the last part, Brennan said. After she was dead, you weren't through. First you gathered up her cards, all except the Ace of Spades, which you dropped on the body to make them think it was me. But that wasn't quite enough, was it? An autopsy would show how she died, and that would point right at you. But the broken bones, the shattered furniture, that suggested a fight. So you did a little more damage to the office. And then, just to make sure, you knelt down and made your fist heavy, so that when you hit her, it would look as though her head had been crushed by someone with superhuman strength. Hiram sagged. I couldn't let myself be caught. Without the kiss, I couldn't face that. And there was the campaign. I was an ace, a Hartman delegate. If it got out, it could destroy everything. Baronet might even win the nomination. So much was at stake. I just panicked. His thick fingers pulled nervously at his beard. It wasn't like you said, so cold, calculated. Wasn't it? Brennan said. You commit murder, try to pin the crime on someone else, and now you say it was all a mistake. I didn't notice you confessing when you thought you'd walked away clean. His gun was aimed at the center of Hiram's chest. You were willing to let me pay for your crime, and when the cops grabbed Elmo instead, you didn't say a word. Brennan's voice was flat and calm, but Jay could hear the fury behind the words. Implacable and deadly. Hiram dropped his head again.
No,
he muttered, low under his breath. No, I didn't. His shame was written all over his face.
If you're gonna kill me, get on with it.
That was when Jay Ackroyd made up his mind and stepped between Hiram Worcester and Daniel Brennan. Get out of the way, Ackroyd, Yeoman said. Daniel, Jay, please, Tachyon said weakly from the chair, where he sat huddled in pain and misery. Both men ignored him. You claim Chrysalis was your friend, Yeoman said. Why are you trying to shield her killer?
It was an accident, Jay said. You heard him. You heard how it happened. Have a little goddamned mercy.
Mercy is God's business, Brennan said. Mine is justice. Tell me about it, Jay said scornfully.
Better yet, tell all those guys you've killed. Tell their widows and girlfriends. Tell their parents. Tell the kids some of them may have left behind.
They knew the risks they were taking. The men I've killed would have killed me just as fast if I'd given them half a chance. I've never murdered an innocent woman. Chrysalis was a lot of things, Jay said. and one of them was my friend, no matter what you think. But she was never innocent.
I knew Chrysalis, Brennan said. She did what she had to.
Fuck that, Jay said.
She did what she chose to. What she chose to do was send a hired assassin to Atlanta. By last count, 2 Secret Service agents, a hotel manager, and a journalist are dead, as a direct result. And we came that close to adding Jack Braun's name to that list. I'm not defending what Hiram did, but in my book, his hands are one hell of a lot cleaner than yours.
Jay, Dr. Tachyon interjected softly.
Brennan's killings are an affair of honor. A blood feud
on Takas. That's Georgia outside the window, not Takas, Jay said. Why the hell are you defending this homicidal loon?
I owe him a life, Tachyon replied.
You owe him a life, Jay repeated with disgust. Real good. Well, you owe Hiram a life too, remember. Not to mention the life you owe me. Come to think of it, you owe fucking Greg Hartman a life. If it really went down in Syria the way the paper said. Then there's a turtle golden boy straight arrow. Is there anyone you don't owe a life?
I owe Brennan 2 lives, the little alien said feebly. I could never betray his trust.
Aykroyd wanted to scream. Instead, he turned back to Yeoman. Well, I don't owe you shit, he said. You want justice? Fine. We'll take Hiram to the police, and he'll go on trial. But let's make it a 2-for-1 sale, shall we? You're great at serving up justice. How about you try a nice big spoonful yourself? Turn yourself in along with Hiram. Stand up in front of a fucking judge and tell him about your war.
I answer to my own conscience, Aykroyd. And frankly, I don't give a damn what you think about it, Brennan said. I'm not turning myself in.
Now for the last time, get out of the way.
There was a long moment of silence.
Jay stared at Brennan. Brennan stared back. Tachyon looked helplessly from one to the other, then struggled to rise from his chair. With only one hand, it was a painful, clumsy process.
I can get a finger up pretty damn quickly, Jay said to Brennan.
The moment you even start to lift that hand, I'm going to squeeze this trigger, Brennan told him. What are the odds on you being able to teleport a bullet in flight?
1,000,000 to 1, Jay admitted.
But only if you don't hesitate. A split second of indecision, and you'll be shooting through the bars in the tombs.
Do I look like the hesitating sort? Brennan asked quietly.
His hand was very steady.
Jay thought about that one, and didn't much like what he came up with. He risked a quick glance back over his shoulder. Hiram sat slumped on the corner of the bed, staring off into space. Completely out of it. Whatever the hell was about to go down, it didn't look like a huge ace was going to be much of a factor.
There's someone else, Tachyon said softly.
His head moved slowly from side to side, searching.
Another mind. In the wall.
Real good, Jay said sourly. He felt ill, but he should have seen it coming.
The Phantom Bimbo, right?
Changes the odds a little, doesn't it? Brennan said, smiling.
Jay flexed his fingers and stared down the barrel of Brennan's Walther. It reminded him how much he hated guns and the kind of assholes who carried them around. From the look in Brennan's cool gray eyes, he had just about run out of time. There was nothing left but to go for it.
Brennan felt a vice clamp down on his brain. For a panicked moment, he thought he was having a seizure of some kind, but then he realized that it was Tachyon. Tachyon's mind control. He raged against it, pushing with all his strength he had in his mind and body, but it was useless. The only part of his body that he could move was his eyeballs. He glanced around the room, and saw Jennifer walk woodenly out of the walls. "Nice work, Doc," Aykroyd said. "Now, no. Look, goddammit, decisions must be made, discussed and made. I've made my decision. And I don't agree," Tachyon said flatly. "Grant me a little consideration in this, Aykroyd. I stand between three friends." The detective stared at Brennan. "Friends," he snorted. Tachyon lowered himself slowly back into his chair. Brennan could see the strain on his face, but the mental vice he'd placed upon Brennan's mind still held. "We will talk," the alien said, "but peace will lie upon this room." Bending, Tachyon pulled his dagger from its boot sheath and dropped it on the carpet at his feet. Jennifer walked woodenly toward Tachyon and dropped her gun next to the knife. Tachyon turned to Brennan. "Daniel, will you lay down your weapon?" There was no sense being stupidly stubborn. There was no way he could break Tachyon's mind control, and there was no way anything further would happen if he insisted on keeping his gun. He nodded, almost imperceptibly. "And Aykroyd," Tachyon asked, "what about you?"
"I hate this Takesian bullshit."
"I could take control of you and make you a dummy in these talks. I would prefer not to."
"Yeah, well, okay."
"Hands in pockets, please." Tachyon released Brennan. He stepped forward and dropped his gun at Tachyon's feet. He looked at the alien with anger and bitterness in his eyes. "You betrayed me," he said. "I prevented murder," the alien snapped. "Self-defense. Oh, please. We bandy with words. Killing. It's all killing. You kill Jay because he attempts to put you in the tombs. You kill Hiram because you get to mete out justice. The end result is all the same. Death. And it's got to stop." Tachyon pressed the heel of his hand against his head, as if trying to push back agony. He turned to Worcester, who had been a mute witness to this all. "Hiram, what do you intend to do?"
"That's already been decided," said Jay. "We'll take—"
"Shut up!"
"Hiram."
"I'll return to New York and turn myself over to the authorities."
"I'll accept that," Brennan said. It was a reasonable end to their difficulties. It was a solution Chrysalis would understand.
"I don't recall him asking your fucking opinion," Jay gritted.
"You better take it into consideration," Brennan said. He turned to face Worcester. "If you get to the airport and change your mind, if you decide to run, you better know now that you'll never have another day's peace. I'll be coming for you."
"You utterly amaze me, Daniel, with your rigid self-righteous certainty," Tachyon said. "Who made you God? Who gave you the right to place your judgment above all others?"
Brennan barked a short, harsh laugh. "That's funny coming from you, Tachyon. Release Jennifer."
"No,"
Tachyon said, shaking his head. "Why not?" Brennan asked, flaring with anger he could no longer suppress. "We have an agreement." Jay plunged forward.
"We've agreed to nothing. Hiram stands trial and maybe goes to prison for a mistake, while this guy walks free? Fuck that! If this little war excuses him, then Hiram should be completely exonerated."
"Jay,"
Tachyon said, shaking his head, "you've allowed your anger to replace your brains. Elmo stands accused of a crime he did not commit. Hiram has confessed to it. He must stand trial."
"Yeah, but we're talking involuntary manslaughter here. Voluntary manslaughter tops. Hiram may walk out of that courtroom with probation."
Jay jerked a thumb at Brennan. "How's Danny Boy going to take that?"
"We'll all have to see, won't we?" Brennan said coldly.
"To hell with that," Jay said. "Why don't we let Hiram write out his confession and then get on a plane to Tibet or wherever the hell he wants to go?"
"He'll die before he ever reaches that plane," Brennan said softly.
"Not if you're behind bars."
Hiram stirred and got off the bed. He no longer looked lost, victimized. It seemed as if he'd made a decision and was determined to carry it through.
"You can talk until you're both damned," he said. "This is my decision to make, and I will go to New York and stand trial because I choose to."
He looked directly at Brennan. "And not because I'm afraid of you."
"I'm not."
Brennan could see that that was true. Hiram had been through the fire and emerged cleansed. He looked as if he feared nothing now.
"Hiram," Jay began.
"Jay, your friendship warms me, but I must do this. I've been a puppet for too long, first with him,
then with Team Alice. But it's all over. I'm through being a puppet.
Hiram's right, Tachyon said passionately. Don't any of you understand? Hiram's trial is critical, not only for Elmo or Hiram, but for all of us. The law is witness of our moral life. Its history is the history of the moral development of your race. But my race upset the balance. We created superhumans, and the result has been a growing chaos. The turtle assaults with impunity because he is armored literally and figuratively with the secret of his identity. I invade people's minds. You, Jay, violate their civil liberties. And Daniel, you kill them. If we don't demonstrate our willingness to abide by the rule of law, then we are everything Barnett says we are. We are dangerous and heedless and deserve to be controlled, since we are unwilling or unable to abide by the rules of civilized society.
That's fascinating, Brennan said dryly. But you missed something. I'm not a wild card. I'm just a gnat. Jay whirled on him.
You bastard! Tachyon, all you've done is convince me that I'm right, and that this killer should be behind...
Jay cut off in mid-sentence. Brennan looked at Tachyon, pale and shaken, who had half risen out of his chair.
Yes, Tachyon said wearily. I am once again playing God. Go, Daniel. Take your lady and go. Never return. If you do, know that I will not aid you.
Jennifer swayed drunkenly when Tachyon released her. Brennan caught her, supported her. He looked back at Tachyon once before he left the hotel suite, and Tachyon looked back. Neither parting glance was kind.
When Brennan and his girlfriend were both gone, Tachyon finally released his iron grip on Jay's body and mind. The alien was trembling, his brow beaded with sweat. Jay ran to the door, jumped out into the hall, looked up and down. There was no one waiting for the elevators. He made a dash for the stairwell, slammed through the fire door, breathing hard. The stairs were empty, silent. They were gone. Swearing loudly with disgust, Jay turned on his heel and stalked back to the room. He slammed the door shut behind him. The noise made Tachyon wince. Jay pointed at him, his arm trembling with tension.
I hope you realize what you've done, he said bitterly. You've just let another demise out onto the streets.
Tachyon looked at him for a long moment. Then the wide lilac eyes rolled up into his head, and the little alien fainted dead away. Oh, hell, Jay said. The perfect ending to a perfect week. He gave Hiram a weary look. Come on, he said. Help me tuck the little fuck into bed.
10 p.m.
Sometimes, Brennan thought, duty was never ending.
He and Jennifer had left Atlanta immediately. They retrieved Brennan's van from the airport parking lot and drove to where the Crystal Palace used to be. Brennan got out and walked over to the ruins. It was dark. There were few pedestrians on the street. There was nothing to bring them here, now that the Crystal Lady was dead, and her palace was gone. Brennan stared at the wreckage for a long moment. The stench of burning was still in the air. The tide of memory still flowed in his mind. He turned and stood before one of the piles of debris that had been around since the Jokertown riot. He waited until he saw eyes blinking inside it. How are you? He asked.
Sad. Our lady is gone, and our home is burned.
I didn't want that to happen, Brennan said.
But it did,
the voice replied accusingly. Yes, Brennan said, it did. Have you found any place else to go? The tiny head shook no.
Yes, you have, Brennan said softly.
11 p.m. Digger Downs was typing furiously on a laptop computer, so engrossed that he didn't notice when Jay stepped into his apartment. You forgot to lock your door, Aykroyd announced loudly. Digger glanced up from the screen, startled, and stared at Jay with a guilty look on his face. The reporter was 4 feet tall, going on 5. He looked like a child playing with a speaking spell.
You? He said.
Me, Jay admitted,
You really ought to lock your door. Never can tell when someone might break in and trash all your stuff.
He looked around pointedly. Digger's apartment was just the way that Mackie Messer had left it.
You have a hell of a lot of nerve showing up here, Digger said. I could have died in that goddamn cat box. They sent me all the way to Alaska.
Alaska, Atlanta, hey, that's close enough for government work, Jay said. He smiled. At least you don't have to eat that airline food.
It's not funny. I ought to sue you, Digger bitched. By the time I finally got to Georgia, I was so big they had to cut me out of the goddamn box.
If it's any consolation, I didn't have a whole lot of fun myself, Jay said. He crossed the room, stepping gingerly over the debris. Anybody ever tell you you're a shitty housekeeper? Digger scowled.
I'm not touching a thing. Not till the photographer's been here.
Jay sighed. I was afraid you were going to say something like that, he said. What are you writing? Digger hurriedly hit a key, storing the file he'd been working on, then slammed down the top of the little laptop computer so Jay couldn't read the file names off the screen.
None of your business, he said. How'd you know I came home?
I'm a detective, remember? Jay said. He cleared himself a space on one end of the sofa and sat down. Let's not make this any harder than we have to. I just want to get the hell out of here, check myself into a hospital, and take some serious painkillers for about a month.
So who's stopping you? Go!
Not till we get something straight. You're not writing anything about Greg Hartman. Digger laughed.
The hell I ain't! This is the story of my life! I'm writing it all. Syria, Berlin, Mackie Messer, the Crystal Palace, everything! I'm going to hang him out and watch him twist in the wind. I figure a special issue of Aces with nothing but the Hartman expose. Or maybe I'll sell it to the Washington Post. Really show that bimbo Sarah Morgenstern a thing or two.
He slapped the computer with his hand.
When this thing comes out, Greg will be lucky if they don't lynch him.
Real good, Jay said wearily. So how many other wild cards will get lynched in his place? Ever think about that?
That's not my concern, Digger said. I'm a journalist, that's all. I just tell the truth and let the pieces fall where they may.
Yeah, Jay said.
Funny, the truth wasn't so important when there was a chance those falling pieces might be coming off your body.
He held up a hand before Downs could interrupt.
Just hear me out, he said. I've already gone over this with Tachyon. He was right. This is a story that can't ever be told. There are reasons, Digger.
He went over them, one by one. Digger was unmoved.
You're asking me to be part of a cover-up, he said when Jay had finished.
Real good, Jay said.
You got it. No way, Down said with righteous indignation. I got ethics. Besides, what about me? Why the hell should I let Hartman off easy? He tried to have me killed. Forget it, Aykroyd.
I know who killed Chrysalis, Jay said. He's going to turn himself in tomorrow morning at the Jokertown precinct house. If you agree to drop the Hartman expose, you can have that story instead. I'll arrange for the killer to give you a complete confession before he goes to the police. Jay had already talked it over with Hiram on the flight home. Hiram had agreed. Hiram was in a frame of mind to agree to most anything that might possibly spare further bloodshed.
It's quite a story, Jay said. It's got blackmail, drugs, sex, death, aces, jokers, the works. Juicy.
He ought to know he'd help Tachyon work out the details. What it didn't have was any mention of Greg Hartman or James Spector. Team Alice was villain enough. You can have an exclusive, Jay promised Digger. In fact, how's this? I'll arrange for the killer to turn himself over to you, and you can deliver him to the cops. For a moment, Digger looked tempted. Then his child's face screwed up in a frown. Do I look stupid or what? The Hartman thing is headlines coast to coast. Talk shows, books, hell, a Pulitzer for sure. Maybe a Nobel. No way am I going to swap that for some penny-ante Joker Town murder. I mean, give me a break. Chrysalis, who cares? She's just another dead joker. I'll throw in some money, Jay said. Digger got indignant. Hey, I don't take bribes. You got it? You can just keep your goddamned money. The American public has a right to know the truth. Jay sighed deeply. He was running out of ammunition. Okay, he said. Have it your way, he stood up. Once you run your little scoop, it's going to get real cold out there for wild cards. But if you think you could stand the chill, hey, who am I to argue? He started for the door. Me, Digger said. Why should I have to stand the chill? Jay turned and looked back at him. You're an ace, aren't you? He said innocently. He touched a finger to the side of his nose and raised a meaningful eyebrow. But no one knows that, Digger said. Jay smiled. You wouldn't, Digger said, horrified. I told you that in confidence, man. If anyone found out, I could be in a world of shit. So true, Jay said sympathetically. You know, if it was up to me, I'd just as soon keep a lid on it, but... He shrugged. The American public has a right to know the truth. His hand was on the doorknob when Digger called out after him. Aykroyd! Jay looked back over his shoulder. Yeah? Downs regarded him thoughtfully. How much money? The reporter asked.
Midnight. They stopped at the Red Apple Rest, a 24-hour restaurant on Route 17. Brennan got out and went inside. I need 17 cheeseburgers, 12-foot-long hot dogs with chili, 3 with mustard and sauerkraut, 26 large fries, 15 Cokes, 10 7-Ups, and 1 large coffee, black.
Jesus, mister, the counterman said. What you got in your van? A pack of starving animals or something?
Just a few friends, Brennan said, laying his money on the counter. Brennan turned as the counterman went to fill his order and looked back over the parking lot. The moon had nearly set. Hanging on the rim of the horizon, it looked to Brennan like a skull, smiling. It took little imagination to add eyes of deepest blue and lips of coral red. He smiled back as it slipped below the horizon and said softly, "Goodbye."
This is Jay Akavone. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Wild Card 7, Dead Man's Hand, by George R. R. Martin and John Joseph Miller. This program was directed by Fred Sanders, executive producer Janet Stark. Text copyright 1990 by George R. R. Martin and the Wild Card Trust. Production copyright 2017, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.